Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
For almost a year, questions about the demise of Alfred Wright have been answered. Yet one voice has been lost in the story, and now we're finally hearing what the Sabine County Sheriff had been holding on to for far too long. Alfred Wright was found dead in a pasture off of Highway 87 in Hemphill last November after he disappeared from the CL&M package store for 18 days, 2 weeks ago. Shane Hadnot was charged with providing the drugs that led to Wright's overdose and untimely death. Now Wright's family claims Hadnot is being used as a scapegoat by Sheriff Tom Maddox. However, our Michelle Reed found out today that is not the case at all. She joins us now with more. Michelle?
Yeah, Christelle. Well, Tom Maddox says they are not using Hadnot in any way as a scapegoat. He says there has been evidence from the very beginning showing that Hadnot allegedly sold the drugs to Alfred, and says no matter how you slice it, this is just a terrible tragedy.
And that's the tragedy there that ought to be reported here. You know, not because of some conspiracy and cover-up, because there, no, that there wasn't. But, you know, the tragedy is, I mean, there that he took the drugs and died because of a drug overdose.
Sheriff Tom Maddox says it's simple. Alfred Wright was not murdered, and his untimely death was all related to drugs.
95% of the people, if they will read that U.S. Attorney's report, you know, and read the indictment there that came out on Shane Hadnot, you know, I mean, that is a perfect timeline of everything there that took place.
Sheriff Maddox says it's still unclear as to when Alfred actually took the drugs on November 7th, but says everything from day one suggests Alfred went into the woods on his own after taking drugs he allegedly got from Hadnot. 2 weeks ago, Wright's parents blamed Sheriff Maddox for covering up what they called the true reason behind Alfred's death, citing a slashed throat, a cutout tongue, and cut off ear as elements of a murder. But Sheriff Maddox says that's simply not true.
His throat was not cut. His, you know, was not sliced. You know, there, his tongue was not cut out. You know, that, you know, nothing of the things there that were said there that happened, you know, took place.
He says that Alfred was found face down in the mud and agrees that insects were to blame for the missing body parts.
We did everything humanly possible there to find Alfred Wright. Now, you know, we did everything there that we possibly could except finding.
Maddox says that Alfred was actually discovered 500 yards away from the initial search site.
It was actually so thick there that there was only two ways there that you were going to find, you know, a person. That was either to step on him or to smell him.
He says he never gave up on the search, despite what many have said, and says the rumors that his daughter was having an affair with Alfred is absurd.
There is no member of my family there that has ever met, you know, Alfred Wright, or knew Alfred Wright.
He says he knows people will continue to say that he didn't do his job, but as far as he knows, he did, and hopes Alfred's family will finally find closure.
Alfred Wright there, you know, apparently there was a very bright young man, had a great family, and, you know, a good job, and I mean, you would think there would just, I mean, live an American dream, and yet it all came to an end because of a drug overdose.
Now, there were some reports that a dime was found next to Alfred's body. Many people said that is a sign of gang activity. Maddox confirmed there was a dime found by a member of a search party, but that dime was found nearly 50 yards away from Alfred's body on a trail back in the woods. Live in the studio, Michelle Reed, KTRE, East Texas News 9.
The cows. Context of white supremacy. Justice Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Monday, August 25th, 2014, so I have been told. We will be back every day for the remainder of the week. We should have Dr. Tommy Curry, also in Texas, will be joining us tomorrow, same program time. On Wednesday, we will have Dr. Charles Hayden. He will be talking about the 1964 murder of an unarmed black teenager in New York, Harlem specifically, by the New York Police Department that led to about 6 days of quote-unquote rioting. He had just done kind of a expose on this incident, the 50-year anniversary of this. And this was almost 50 years to the day that Eric Garner was choked to death by New York Police Department, the New York Police Department, back in July. I asked him to be a guest on the program then, and he did not, he was not able to get in contact with me until about a week or so ago. So everything that he was talking about became much more relevant as a result of what has unfolded in the month of August. So he will be with us on Wednesday, Black Male. Thursday, Mr. Norm Stamper. For folks who heard Dr. Frances Cresswell's in yesterday, she had quite a bit to say about the significance of Mr. Norm Stamper's work. Former chief of police here in Seattle, Washington. He's been with us twice before. He'll be here on Thursday. Our book club will be back this coming Friday and the compensatory call-in Saturday. So a very active week as the summer winds down. Quickly, I thought Theodore Wafer would be sentenced today for the murder of Renisha McBride. He was convicted August 7th, 2 days before Michael Brown Jr., was shot and killed. His sentencing was originally scheduled for today. It was moved to September 3rd, which is next Wednesday. So I will be waiting, and we'll definitely have the update once that comes out next Wednesday. That being said, the audio clip you heard at the beginning of the broadcast, Alfred Wright, the Black male, if folks remember, this happened towards the end of 2013, where Black male, he was married to a white woman. He had been missing for some time. No one knew what happened to him. Local police officials near Wright, Jasper, Texas, should be significant for many reasons. But they said that they had done a search. They didn't find anything. The family went out and searched almost the exact same spot where the police said that they searched originally, and they found his body. The family reported that the Mr. Wright's throat had been slashed, that his tongue was missing, his ear was missing. It seemed some of his clothing had been removed. It seemed very suspicious to them, as well as the conduct of the investigating enforcement officials in the case. Did not really hear much more about it. I know CNN, they had done quite a few reports about this case around the end of 2013, beginning of 2014, and then it vanished. Nothing more was really said about it, or at least I didn't hear any more about it. But then this month, they have indicted a Black male for drug charges and saying that Mr. Wright died from an overdose. And this Black male sold him the drugs. It seems that quite a few folks are incredulous about all of this. In my opinion, it is very relevant for what we will be discussing today, as well as Jasper, period. Folks should definitely remember Mr. James Byrd Jr. Very relevant. And even Mr. Rodney Pete, Rodney Pearson, Black male. He was one of the, I think he was the first Black sheriff in Jasper, Texas. And he was unceremoniously fired, relieved of his duties. He filed a lawsuit. We had his attorney on the program last year, and he actually won his lawsuit. We had the update a while back, but he won his lawsuit. He got, I think, close to $1 million settlement reward from the city of Jasper for wrongful termination, what he felt was them practicing racism against him. I think all of this is very relevant for what we will be discussing on today's broadcast, as well as what has been happening in Ferguson over the past 2 weeks and change now, with Michael Brown Jr.'s funeral being today. Our guest for today's program, I think one of our listeners informed me about his work, which details really an act of white terrorism in the early 1900s in Slocum, Texas. For folks who are familiar with some of the more, talked about, discussed, reported on incidents where Black people have been banished from a particular region, Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma, Rosewood down in Florida, Wilmington, Delaware. There are many examples of what we will be discussing today. If you have been listening to the Cows long enough, you will remember when Mr. Elliot Jaspin was a guest on the program to discuss his book, Buried in the Bitter Water, where he talks about that there were at least 200 incidents of these types of racial cleansings. That's the term that he used, where white people by force went into a particular area and demanded that the black people vacate, sometimes killing them in the process, sometimes telling them that they had until sundown to vacate the area. Sometimes the black people were only able to leave with the clothing on their back. Sometimes, you know, they didn't even escape. Sometimes they died in the process. And I said a few weeks ago, I said this should be included when people talk about what they call gentrification, racial dislocation. This should be a part of that conversation, because this is the exact same thing, just being done, in my opinion, in a much more vulgar form, forcing people to leave at gunpoint. But that is a major aspect of what happened and what we'll be talking about today. Rosewood, Tulsa, a lot of the other incidents, black property being confiscated and either taken outright, no compensation, or what they call a fire sale, where you get large swaths of land for pennies, where nowhere near the actual market value for the property is being given to the black person, where they're just saying, you're going to get out and maybe we'll give you a nickel for your 10 acres of land and that's it. But major acts of white terrorism, racism, many of these incidents do not get recorded. Our guest for today's broadcast, he wrote an article about this, didn't really find much information on this incident. He was approached by a publisher to expand that article into a book. He did so. That book is The 1910 Slocum Massacre. Fascinating work. Excited to have the chance to speak with him, as well as some of the descendants of this really tragic event in Texas. Joining us live from Texas, the author, Mr. E.R. Bills. Let me see if I can get the correct number here. I thought I would have names, and I've just got area codes. Let's see if I can. Let's see. Give me a moment to see if I can find the correct number. Mr.
Hey, Gus. Oh, ER.
Gotcha. Outstanding. First time. Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your time with us, Mr. Bills. Really great to have you on the program and to discuss your outstanding work. Anything for folks, this might be their first time hearing about you, your book, anything that you think audience members should know about your work before we get started?
Well, nothing in particular. I mean, I've been writing for really freelance for about 6 or 7 years, and just picked up this story, as I told you when we spoke before, I don't know, probably a year and a half ago, but excited about the book. I'm excited to be here and talk to you about it.
Right on. For folks who have not seen you, you are a white man, is that correct?
Yes. Yes, I am a white man.
Right on. Yes. Right on. Definitions, very important, particularly in my opinion, when discussions on racism are taking place. The term racism, I use that as a synonym for the term white supremacy. I use those two words interchangeably. And the definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists, and do you think that's an accurate definition?
Well, I had problems following you a little bit there. I don't like the phrase. That's a good question. I tell you what. When I was thinking the day before the show, white supremacy at the end of the name of the show. Of course, I didn't like it, but only because I didn't like the root word supreme, you know, which is, it lends itself to superior. I personally don't think there is a superior ethnicity or a supreme one, but as far as a systemic pattern of one ethnicity subjugating the others, I think that that is happening. I think that has happened. And, you know, I think the way you frame it, we're obviously talking about white people here. It's gone on. It's going on. So I guess I don't, it doesn't terribly bother me, you know. In particular, I think it would make many white people uncomfortable, perhaps. So, you know, but I'm comfortable with starting there.
Right on. I think I have been known for saying on this program, with regards to hopefully finding a permanent solution to this problem, we need to get comfortable being uncomfortable. I would also say, I'm just looking at the definition for supreme, adjective, of an authority or office, someone holding it. It reads superior to all others, a unified force with a supreme commander. The next definition is strongest, most important, or most powerful. The next definition is very great or intense, extreme. In my opinion, that is extremely accurate with regards to white people and their power relationship to everyone they classify as not white, and their aims to making sure that they are superior to everybody that they say is not white, that they are in the strongest and most important, most powerful position as it relates to non-whites, and their conduct, and I would say, I would go to your book as Exhibit A, very great or intense, extreme. I think your book is a wonderful illustration of extreme and intense power used by white people to maintain their superior position over individuals they classify as not white. But I could be...
Yeah, we just have a... I agree. I think it's just a matter of syntax and connotation and denotation. I don't agree with what you're saying, but you know the Republicans are all back. They stopped referring to the Democratic Party as Democratic Party. They just say the Democrat Party, because Democratic is a positive sort of suggestive, you know, connotation of something that's good. So they changed sort of the nomenclature on their end to sort of edge that off. Well, the definition for supreme, I agree. I don't have a dictionary in front of me, but I think you're probably correct. But it doesn't say white in there. So, in my opinion, I think I would almost use the Republican tactic. I wouldn't use the word superior or supreme anywhere near the word white. let's remove it from the discussion. You know, I mean, I don't have a problem with the title of your show. I'm just saying, when I thought about it earlier, I just thought, you know, that's part of the problem there. You know, some people, when they discuss black people, of course, they use the, you know, they welfare or whatever. I mean, that shouldn't be discussed or it shouldn't be something people automatically seize on when they think of black people. Of course, African Americans. And in my opinion, that's how we change the debate. You and I don't think either of us were comfortable with this idea of superiority or supremacy. You know, the skinheads, of course, cornered that market. The white supremacists is what they call them, but they're not supreme. They're not superior. And, you know, I think that's the only point I was just making, is that,
what would be the most accurate term if there's,
you know what? I think that would be interesting to explore, exploiters. I don't know the exploitative, you know, I don't know. Your show opens up so many lines of thought, and, you know, for me as a white person, that I've never really thought about before. I mean, I just haven't thought of it. I'd never thought that about the word supreme or superior. I had never, that never occurred to me. But when I saw the title of your show, it made me think about it, and it's made me think differently about it. So I'm sorry I interrupted. I interjected there, but, go ahead. I mean, I'm on board with the definition. I'm on board with the description of what's happening in this country and really across the planet. But I think, you know, and Constance and I spoke about this the other day, the context of white supremacy, you know, is a whole other argument. I do have a word for that. I think that's almost like a question. I think I could answer it in one word. I think the context for white supremacy is capitalism. Mm-hmm. And I think it's behind every bit of it, every bit of the disenfranchisement, you know, denying people their land, denying people their place, bringing folks over here to labor, all necessities of capitalism. Somebody has to be on the short end of the stick. So I think that's what the context of white supremacy is.
Interesting.
That's a whole different subject, I understand.
Right, right. I'll come back to that once we get an opportunity to kind of go over some of the aspects of your book. And I want to hear from, can you pronounce Miss Constance, her last name? Can you pronounce it for me so I'm not messing it up?
It's Constance Holly Jawade.
Jawade. Constance Holly Jawade. Am I saying it correctly?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Ms. Jawade, I think I see your line. I'm going to get your line. Just if you can give me a couple seconds to kind of go over some of the particulars of Mr. Bill's book, and then I'll open your line. But I do see you, and thank you so much for dialing in. We're going to add her to the discussion as well so we can get some of her background, how she and Mr. Bills came in contact, and kind of some of her thoughts about what he talks about in his book as well. Just give me a couple seconds to kind of go over some of the particulars, and then I will add you to the line as well. You talked about when we spoke before the broadcast, you talked about kind of what pushed you in the direction of doing this research. Your book started off with an article. You said that you saw the famous, infamous in some circles, movie The Help, which is based on a fictional story. You saw that movie and you had some thoughts when one of the black characters was talking about the assassination of Medgar Evers. Could you expound?
Yes, sir. It's been a couple years ago, at least. I was watching the movie, as you said, The Help, and it came to the scene where Viola Davis's character is on the bus home, rushing to get home. Medgar Evers has just been assassinated, and it's a very poignant scene. And Viola Davis's character says, "They're going to kill us all." And I remember, I don't know if smugly or naively, you know, it was a moving scene, but I remember thinking to myself, those yokels in Mississippi, I mean, I just thought, you know, this is pathetic. This is, it's incomprehensible to me. Something like that could never happen in Texas. And then, of course, a few months later, I stumbled onto this story, and I saw that something like this basically had happened in Texas. And I was shocked, and, you know, I was sort of ashamed of my naivete, and that sort of started the journey.
Wow. I would also encourage folks to check out in the archives Monty Akers. He's also a white male. He wrote the book Flames After Midnight. He was on the broadcast in 2011. The incident that we're talking about today in Slocum, Texas, this is not even the only such incident that took place in Texas. As I said, there are many, many, many incidents of this white terrorism, white people going into an area and killing a lot of black people and or demanding that they vacate their property and exit the town. Monty.
Excuse me one second, okay, Gus? I'll be right back to you.
Yes, sir. Monty Akers, Flames After Midnight. Again, the full title, the book that we're discussing today, Mr. E.R. Bills, The 1910 Slocum Massacre, An Act of Genocide in East Texas. Once Mr. Bills gets back, I want to get him to explain. He gives the definition of genocide at the very beginning of his book. Might even read it while he is out. I'm assuming he remembers what he wrote in the book so that we're not taking up too much time. This is on page
Okay, sorry. This is Eddie.
Okay. Cool. I'm flipping to the beginning so that I can get the there we go. In the preface. So this is before the actual text begins. But you start off the text with the definition of genocide. And it reads, in the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. A. Killing members of the group. B. Causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group. C. Deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. This is from the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. He starts this, again, is from the preface. Why did you include this at the very beginning of your book, Mr. Bills?
Well, Gus, genocide is a loaded term. And most of the preliminary reports on the story never exactly got down to the bottom of how many people were killed. And then later, the official story only suggested 7 or 8. But the evidence seemed to suggest many, many more folks. And I knew that I would have to establish a case if I wanted to use the term genocide. My editor wasn't comfortable with it. They were interested in maybe selling more copies with something a little more toned down. I knew that when people dug into the book, you know, it's a loaded term. So I started doing some research on genocide. And of course, you know, I stumbled across the Genocide Convention, and I wanted to put that right out front. You know, it wasn't a shot over the bow. You know, it was there to demonstrate exactly what happened. Just go ahead and lay the groundwork for the case I was going to make. And that was that there were at least dozens killed, probably more like hundreds. And then, as you mentioned earlier in your show, you know, not only was there a slaughter, there was also a racial expulsion. Thousands probably fled off this land that they had lived on, you know, since slavery. So several different aspects of the Genocide Convention fit what happened in Slocum in 1910, you know, as well as other places, point out in Elliot Jaspin's book. I mean, just all over the place, really. Terrible chapters, beyond sad, you know, unconscionable, reprehensible. If I was going to use a term like that, I wanted to be able to back it up. And since most people maybe don't understand the word completely, they immediately seize on, you know, the Jews during the Holocaust or the Armenians. You know, they don't really think of African Americans in those terms. They don't think of the American Indian in those terms. But an excellent case can be made in both of those examples of genocide. And so I just wanted to lay the groundwork for the case I was going to make.
Given what you document in your book, and the fact, as you pointed out, Mr. Elliot Jaspin, I would also reference Mr. Cameron McWhirter, who is also a white male, who was on this program. He wrote the book Red Summer. The summer of 1919 and the awakening of Black America, where he also documents a lot of these same types of events that happened all over, not just in the South, Chicago, Arkansas, Washington, D.C., all over, as you said. Given that there are so many hundreds, as Mr. Jaspin writes, of these types of incidents, given that and given the current context, the country, for really the whole world, for about the past 2 weeks has been focused on Ferguson, Missouri, what's happened there, and particularly in relating these to the many other incidents, James Byrd Jr., also in Texas, Alfred Wright, also in Texas, Eric Garner, New York. Do you think that there is still a genocide being waged against Black people in this area of the world, perhaps even worldwide?
Well, again, it's a loaded term. I think there are still... I would have to unload it, and I'd have to think, yeah, you're making me think. I would have to think about it further, but I would say there are still genocidal acts being committed. Is there a pattern of genocide or a sort of a long-running, intermittent process of genocide? That might be a harder case to make in the present day, Although there are still casualties, you know, there are still things going on. I think there's an ongoing if you go down the definitions, there's an ongoing disenfranchisement. There's ongoing oppression. But obviously there are more opportunities today. You know, there are better situations in other places in the country for African-Americans. So I don't know that I'd say the genocide is necessarily still happening. This is more like, it's sort of like the dystopian, you know, epilogue or something, in my opinion. But some of the motivations, some of the frightful ignorance behind this, some of the evil intent, some of the sense of entitlement, it's still here. It's still here. I wrote a column for Fort Worth Weekly this week, and I talked about how I just hardly don't recognize white people anymore. The bitterness, the vitriol, the inanity, the asininity. You know, if we didn't have a black president, whether you like what he's doing or not, okay, but if we didn't have a black president, there wouldn't be white people standing around saying they've got to take their country back. That's just the facts, okay? If we didn't have a black president, okay, we wouldn't have people going to Home Depot with firearms, intent on someday maybe taking their country back. I fully suspect, and this people are going to say this is an outrageous claim, but I just can't help but suspect that if we didn't have a black president, the Zimmerman character, George Zimmerman, he might have been convicted. If we didn't have a black president, I just don't think so many unarmed black folk in this country would be getting shot down. I mean, it's almost like you can't, I wouldn't even make the argument that it's conscious on white folks' level. You know, it could be subconscious or an unconscious urge or an anxiety that they have. I don't know what's behind it, but I just suspect, you know, that there's a lot of pent-up frustration. And, you know, I think if we can't take it out on the president, we'll take it out on people who look like him. And I'm not talking about me personally, but I'm talking about, as you referenced at the beginning of the show, white people. It's history is going to judge this period pretty severely. You know, I think it's pretty sad, and it's kind of disgusting on many levels. And, you know, it's sort of shameful. And, you know, as a person who grew up in the 80s, I think I heard somebody earlier in the show talking about being around the 80s. You know what? I don't even remember people being this racist then. I think it's worse now than it was, you know, on several levels. And I think it's because we have a black president. I don't think a lot of people, they're just completely comfortable with it. They might even have voted for him. But it's like, again, they're just not comfortable with it. And it's a strange situation, a strange atmosphere I feel like I'm living in. You know, even as a white person, you know, obviously I'm not African American. I don't have to go through what they go through on a daily basis, but I'm made uncomfortable by things that are said. You know, I was with somebody the other day. You know, I am a white person. I'm not, I don't wear long hair. I don't wear earrings or, you know, tattoos. I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't look, well, that's a stereotype. I don't look like your typical liberal or progressive. And so a lot of white folks, and they're around me, they feel
racist?
Pretty comfortable. Huh?
They assume you're racist?
Well, but yeah, they assume I'm maybe, racist or have more of the normal conservative disposition. And one of them said the other day, you know, Obama, he's just another nigger in public housing. You know, as in the White House's it's public housing. That was their joke to me. And I was sort of startled. You know, I had no idea it was sort of coming. They were trying to even ingratiate themselves to me. You know, I'm sort of a meaty, stocky-looking white guy. And it was like they were trying to be friendly, and they threw that out in almost normal conversation. And I was sort of aghast, frankly.
What did you say? How did you respond?
You know what? I was in the crowd, and I didn't really say much about it, frankly. I let it go.
Wow.
You know, the old choose your battle sort of thing. And again, I was sort of dumbstruck too. You know, I'm not a person usually. I try not to be too reactionary. Okay, I can get carried away, and I can get pretty fired up. And sometimes I say things that I regret. And so, as I've gotten older, I try to be, I try to be more thoughtful about things. I try to be more careful. And really, it's hard to leave me dumbstruck. I mean, really. But if you do, I'm literally dumbstruck. I can't believe it. I'm just at first not sure how to respond. The conversation had gone on to other things by then, but I was dumbstruck. But you know what? It happens every day. It happens at water coolers. It happens, you know, in some locker rooms. It happens on police forces. A lot of white people, Rush Limbaugh listeners, Fox News viewers, you know, these programs, they feed on things like racism, you know, and it's just pretty common among white folks these days, sad to say. I don't include myself in their number. But obviously, if I looked more progressive, if I'd been carrying my Mac bag or something and had a Starbucks in my hand, I don't know what people's stereotype of liberals is, but maybe they wouldn't have spoke that way. But since I guess the way I look, they felt comfortable going on all over the place.
Fascinating, fascinating. Context of white supremacy. Miss Constance Holly Jawade, I'm coming to you. I'm going to ask Mr. Bills one more question, and then I'm coming to you. And even if you want to prepare, I generally don't do this, but if you want to prepare your first question, do you think, according to the definition that Mr. Bills outlines in his book, do you think that there is still a genocide being waged against black people? That's question number one, so you can be thinking of your response. Mr. Bills, I just want to get a quick answer. You, in your commentary, and for listeners, you have another example. Dr. Welsing, she was just with us yesterday, where she says we should be asking white people what they talk about with other white people when there are no non-white people around. I think you just got another example. And the question that I ask pretty regularly, every person that I've ever, this is one of the few things that I can say I've always got the exact same answer, and it's always concise. There's no hemming and hawing, no pussyfooting. It's always an immediate, yep. When I ask, if you are a white person, do racist white people assume that if you are white, you too are racist? Every single time, the answer I've gotten is yes. And that's why I go to black people and I say, well, if racists assume that you're white, and that if you're white, you're racist, if you are a black person, a non-white person, wouldn't it be logical for you to make the same assumption? At any rate, the question I wanted to ask, you said that you were talking about the what you see amongst white people right now, and that there might even be a correlation between President Obama being in the White House and this rash of shootings of unarmed black people and just flagrant abuse. They had an incident in Texas over the past couple of days where a black female and her black children were stopped at gunpoint by officers. It was mistaken identity. They stopped the wrong car. It wasn't even the correct color or the correct type model of vehicle, but they stopped them, pulled them out at gunpoint. The kids or their children are crying and just in hysterics. Black family that this happened to, in addition to everything else in Ferguson and what have you. And you said there could be a correlation to President Obama being in the White House and just seeing so many white people who are upset and saying that they need to take their country back. And you seem to suggest that maybe some part of this was the result of ignorance. What exactly is it that you think white people are ignorant about or unaware of that is producing this racist behavior?
Well, that's a tough thing to answer quick. Racism itself is a misnomer. There's only one race, the human race. And anybody that has a half a brain, in my opinion, or does any thinking about it, realizes we're all not that much different. And so, you know, to judge a person by the color of their skin, to judge a person by the hue, by their hue, it's based on ignorance. It's based on not having thought through the information right in front of you. But unfortunately, I think it's cyclical. You know, in my opinion, and as a white person being around a lot of white people, they can be otherwise decent people, but most of the people I know who are racist, it has a lot to do with their upbringing. And they don't transcend their upbringing. They might go off to college and be hippies for a while, but you know, really most people, they revert back to their default settings. And if you grow up in a house where your parents are racist or sexist or whatever, and they teach you to be, you may transcend it for a while in college, but then later, a lot of people, they start reverting back to their default settings, and it's ignorant. And I think, and it's based on ignorance. It's promulgated by ignorance. It seems to me, you know, Gus, I don't know how you feel about it, but it just seems to me it wouldn't require much thought to sort this out, to see that we're not that much different, to see that white people are no better. And in my opinion, and this may, you know, you may disagree, or some folks might disagree, no worse. They may have acted worse. Black folk are no worse, no better. Asians, you know, the Aborigines, you know, we're all human beings. And I'm not inclined to think any ethnicity is any better or worse than the other, and that we're sort of in this together. And, you know, I may be naive again, but it just seems to me that anybody who honestly and rationally considers that would come to the same conclusion. And if you come to that conclusion, then how can you sign off on lapses of racism or disenfranchisement or slaughter, genocide? You know, how can that not be unconscionable? So on a large scale, you could say it's stupidity, ignorance, evil. You know, Albert Camus, one of my heroes, said there's no such thing as evil. There's only ignorance. I'm inclined to agree. And I think it's behind all of this, you know, everything.
If anyone is ignorant about racism, it's black people.
Context of white supremacy that has come up frequently on the program. If white people are ignorant, or somehow white people's ignorance producing racism. I will stick to my word. We are fortunate enough. In fact, I'm going to also, after I ask my first question about genocide against black people, I'm going to get one of the descendants to kind of give us the overview from what she heard, her understanding of what happened with the Slocum Massacre, before we go back to Mr. Bill's book and some of the things he wrote, how they met in the first place. But always, in my opinion, fantastic when you can go directly to the source and talk to some of the black people who directly experienced this. And give them an opportunity to voice what they have to say about all this. I know a lot of our guests have said before that one of the really nefarious aspects of racism is that frequently black people do not get an opportunity to give their own voice to what has happened to them, to tell their own story, that frequently it's racists who have the pen in their hand or the microphone where they get to decide how history is going to be told. So I was really excited to have one of the descendants on to kind of give her perspective, her understanding of the events, and what she was told from her family members. So also joining us live on the program, Miss Constance Holly Jawade. Miss Jawade, thank you so much for being patient. Are you with us, ma'am?
Yes, I am.
Outstanding.
Hi. So,
so glad we can have you on the program. Really looking forward to hearing your views as well. If you heard, I had already said that my first question was going to be about if you think there's a continuing war of genocide against black people. I guess before I get to that, is there anything you think listeners should know about you and the work that you do?
I'm a principal here in the Dallas area. And as Mr. Bill said, I'm also a descendant. I'm the great-granddaughter of one of the primary landowners in Slocum, Texas.
Outstanding. My question to you, Ms. Jawade, do you think that there is a continuing genocide being waged against black people?
I most definitely do. I believe there's a systemic annihilation against blacks waged by whites. If you look at the definition in the book, what's happening to blacks in this country today fits to a T the definition of genocide. by the what's happening in Florida, what happened in Missouri, what's happening in New York, what happened in Texas, and probably every state in this union. There is, in my opinion, used to be covert or less covert, but there's a covert operation, systemic, to kill the black race.
Wow. When did you, is this a conclusion that you've had for a while? Is this something that you've come to recently? How long have you, you know, felt this?
I believe this all of my adult life, since I lost the innocence of childhood into thinking this country really believed that we were one nation under God and all equal and individual. When I lost that naivete and lost that innocence of childhood, I became astutely aware of what was being waged against blacks.
Wow. All right, then.
And not just in murder, but I also consider genocide to be the kind of foods they put in our neighborhood. The liquor, the imprisonment of black men at a disproportionate rate. We're only 12% of the population, but what percent of the prison population here in Texas? That's an act of genocide. The number of men we have on death row here in Texas who are African American, that is genocide. And every other week you see a man, a black man, getting released by Governor Perry or DNA once they have evidence that, no, he didn't do it. But how many black men have gone before him and given their life on a crime they were falsely accused of? It's not by accident that those things happen. That's genocide legalized.
Genocide legalized. I am in agreement with the subject matter of Mr. Bill's book, The Specific Act of Genocide in Slocum, Texas. I had never even heard of Slocum. Would have probably struggled to try and find that on a map of Texas. For our listeners, can you kind of explain what was shared with you about what happened in this incident, what your understanding of what happened in 1910 Slocum, Texas?
Yes. My grandfather, who passed away this past March, he would have been 100 years old had he lived in to July. So he was born just 4 years after the massacre. His father was a survivor. He's one of the people in the book. That his name is Marsh, that you hear about. Well, my great-grandfather owned the only store in Slocum. He did business or provided goods and services to black and whites alike. And there were whites who were infuriated by this, who thought he was an uppity nigger. And because of this, they spread rumors and lies and killed members of my family, shot, wounded members of my family, and took the granary, the mercantile store, and 700 acres of prime, fertile land in East Texas. And Texas still refuses to give it back. So I heard about this through my grandfather, through my father, my uncle. It's just, it was, you know, everybody who is a Holly, they know about this from birth. You're told of what happened, and you're told to carry the torch for the family. In the event that the elders die, it's your turn to fight for justice. Don't give up. And so it's my turn to pick up where my grandfather left off or my father left off. They're no longer with us, to make sure that Texas, that we pull back the carpet of this secret and expose Texas, the governor, whomever, for not aiding and assisting us in seeking justice. So it's my turn.
Right on.
And I have two children, ages 12 and 18. They know the story, because if this thing isn't resolved in my lifetime, guess what? They're going to pick it up. That is what we must do as a people, as family. We must teach our children our history so they don't have to repeat it, but also so they can rectify the wrongs against their ancestors.
Ashe.
That's my opinion.
At what age, both, I guess it's a two-part, at what age did you begin to tell your children about this incident, and at what age do you recall your father or other family members beginning to tell you information about this?
I remember my father first telling me about, my first memory is age 9, where he drove us to Slocum, my brother and I, and showed us where the store was and all the land and who lived where, and now that land is just covered with oil pumps and what happened. So it was age 9. And I started teaching my kids about their history, you know, as soon as, you know, I use that to teach them language. Some folks read Cat in the Hat, Dr. Seuss, but I read to my children things that are historically relevant to them. Forget Dr. Seuss, Cat in the Hat, you can get that some other time. But I started early with them, age 3, age 4, teaching them through their history.
Oh. That is music to my ears. That's one of the best things I've heard in, wow, months. Easily the best thing I've heard in the month of August. Outstanding. You do not need to use Cat in the Hat and Dr. Seuss and what have you to teach your children reading and language. You can teach them about things that are relevant to them as a Black person.
I can teach them how to read through the context of things that are historically significant to them as Black individuals. And they read better than anyone their age, or just as well as anyone their age. We just chose to use fact and not fiction.
Do you get pushback from other folks, even some other Black people, to say, hey, wait a minute, if you're doing that, Miss Jahade, that you will encourage your children to hate white people, or, you know, you'll make them angry or what have you?
Yes, I get that from Black and white alike, that the past in the past, and don't teach your children that stuff. That's hate filled. No, that's not hate filled. If it's hate filled, I didn't write it. It's what's happening. I'm just reporting it to my children. So if it's hate, it's not me, the messenger, that's making it hateful. It's the act itself that is filled with hate. And I have the duty to report that to my Black son. I'm not going to let him go out into the world thinking that he has the same rights and privileges as a white male does, or can approach a situation with the police with the same protocol as a white male does. And my son gets killed because I wanted to tell him something that wouldn't offend white people. If you're offended by it, change it. So I can tell a different story. But I'm just reporting what's happening. Now, if what I'm reporting, I'm not being hate, I'm not spreading hate for reporting it, I'm reporting your hate. That's the difference.
Local principal in the state of Texas, Miss Constance Holly Jahade. Make sure I get the name correct, Jahade. Again, phenomenal, phenomenal illustration, in my opinion, of what we should all be doing as attempted Black parents. Be honest with your children so they are not confused about what's happening in Ferguson, what they're seeing on the news every day, so that they have a clear understanding of how Black people are treated in the system of racism, white supremacy. That is monumental duty as a parent. That's one of your most important obligations, in my opinion. I guess, have you gotten in any trouble? Like, have people, you know, made an effort to try to get you to be quiet about this, or to not talk about this, to kind of hush you about all this?
Yes, some of my older relatives, my elders, who still fear, you know, whites, because, you know, because they grew up during that period 80 or 90 years ago, want me to be careful. They want me to be quiet because they're concerned about my safety. And I understand that. But there are other people who just want me to be quiet, not because they're concerned about my safety, just because they want me to leave it alone. You make it hard for me or them as a white person to execute their plan if you're revealing what they're doing. So I want my children to be able to peep what's happening. And that's why they want me to be quiet. My children are not going to go in the world oblivious and thinking that they are going to be treated with the same dignity and respect with someone with less melanin than them. Because if my children get killed because I chose not to tell them the truth, I blame myself for their murder.
Wow. Outstanding. Outstanding. Did you meet Mr. Bills before the book was published or after the book was published?
I met him before the book was published. He did an article for the Austin Statesman. Is that right, ER? Can you hear me? He did an article for the Austin Statesman. And
Yes, we can hear you, sir.
Oh, okay. Austin American Statesman. Go ahead,
Constance. Austin American Statesman. And he called me at work. I was doing my principal duties, and I got a message from my secretary that he called, and I called him back, and he told me that he was interested in the Slocum Massacre, and if I'd be interested in helping him, giving him information to write the article. So that's how we met. He saw the state of Texas did a resolution in March of 2001 recognizing the Slocum Massacre. They came just short of apologizing for it. It was more of a recognition than an apology. And he knew about that, so he was trying to do a story about that. And that's how we connected in 2011.
Constance, 2011.
Yes, 2011.
Right. Yeah,
2011. Did you, Ms. Jouaid, did you have any suspicion of Mr. Bill, seeing as he is a white man?
Yes, and I believe I told him this before. I didn't trust him. Like, why is this white man wanting to help support this cause? He must have a hidden agenda. He had to prove himself and his intentions to me before I became comfortable in working with him.
I want to ask you how you went. What was that process like of him proving himself to you? But Mr. Bills, when she made this known that she did have some suspicions about your intentions and if you had a hidden agenda, how did you respond?
Well, she wasn't the first, so I'd had some practice. A lot of African Americans that I tried to talk to were very suspicious of a white guy looking into this. You know, what end of it was I on? And they did go about sizing me up, and frankly, you know, I can't blame them. You know, the white folks really did the same thing to me. Everybody was kind of curious of what I was up to, and so I was guarded, but not with Constance. I told her what I was planning to say. I told her that I would not, you know, hold anything back. And I would not, there'd be no favoritism for my, for the white folks, even though I am one. I wanted to tell the story. I thought it needed to be told. There was an urgency about it, you know, in my mind, because, you know, just the general facts known at the time were so preposterous and so inaccurate. So, so I just told her that I was going to approach it seriously and honestly.
Yes, he was very open and transparent, so he made it quite easy for me to know that he had no angle, that he was a straight shooter. What he was saying and what he was doing was exactly that. There were no hidden agendas. So transparency really helped.
Okay. Did he give you any assurances like, hey, you know, I'll allow you to kind of review some of what I'm writing before it goes to publish so you can kind of give you...
No.
Okay.
No, then that's not because he didn't want to. There was something that happened that kept us from communicating while he was writing. So it was a miscommunication, and that was resolved after he published the book, and all is well.
Okay. Fascinating. I guess I want to get some more of the details that you bring out in the book that I think are important, because some of these are trends and some of these even revolve around words. That's something that we talk about on the program all the time. Definitions, words, just critically important when people begin to talk about racism, white supremacy. I want to get to that, but I do see people have called in and have questions as well. So I'll give out the number again. It is 760 569-7676. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you have questions, either for Mr. E.R. Bills or Miss Constance Holly Jawaid, either or. Let's see. First, I'll see if our co-host Justice, if she has any questions, and then I'll nab the other folks that have dialed in as well. Justice, did you have any questions for our guests? Your line should be open.
I'm just listening for the time being, but I will let you know if I do. Thank you.
Cool in the gang. Let's see. Caller at 1184, last four digits, 1184. Did you have a question for Mr. Bills and or Ms. Jawaid? Caller at 1184, are you just listening or did you have a question? One more check. 1184, do you have a question or are you just listening? Okay, I will assume they are just listening or maybe having some microphone problems. You can dial back in. If you were talking and we just couldn't hear you, just hang up and dial back in and I'll get your hand and get you on the line. Mr. Demery Four, did you have a question for our guests?
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Okay. Evening, Mr. Renegade. Good evening to the guests, Mr. Beals and Ms. Hollis. I have a couple of questions, but I'd like to know how many people were actually massacred. One, and I'd like to know if there was anyone brought to justice for the atrocities, and I'd like to know how did something of this magnitude get hidden for all of these years. And I understand there was a telegraph sent to the governor of Texas, and I'd like to know a little bit about that too. Okay, I'll mute my line and take the answer. Thank you for stopping by the program.
Constance, you want me to take that one?
I'll start with the first question. We can volley back and forth. You can take the next question. The estimates are that upwards of 200 people were killed. There are mass graves, and we know the locations approximately of those mass graves. And I've been petitioning, along with Mr. Bills, the state of Texas, to unearth those mass graves so we can give my relatives and those other African Americans in Slocum proper burial and funeral rites. But the estimate is upward of 200.
Yeah, I would concur. I would say that's really what attracted me to the story. If you go back and when you first look at the newspaper reports, you know, the newspapers say, oh, you know, 20 dead, 24 dead, 18 dead, and then the police say 7 or 8 dead. So the number dropped, and that's strange, not terribly off-putting. But the sheriff, the white sheriff, whose name was Black, Sheriff Black, he said, you know, and Constance, I'm sure, remembers, he said, there are black bodies everywhere. I mean, there are black bodies everywhere. Mobs of white people went around killing as many black people as they could find, you know, and run down. And there are bodies everywhere, and the buzzards are going to find them first. Okay, so I read that statement, and I thought, 7 or 8? Really? Hundreds of white people armed, killing unarmed black people, and they could only kill 7 or 8? Didn't sound right. Didn't add up to me. It looked suspicious. And that's what made me look into it further and deeper. And the further and deeper I looked into it, you know, along those lines, I stumbled across this notion of other mass graves, you know, and a number that I think could even exceed 200. You know, 92. In my opinion, if you have that many, I mean, you know what? One armed white man or black man could kill 7 or 8 people in a 12-hour period on a bad day. Especially if they were unarmed and unsuspecting. We're talking about 200-300 armed, you know, white folks going around in separate mobs, combing the area that was thickly settled with Negroes. That's how they put it. That's their terminology, their vernacular. Thickly settled, and they only killed 7 or 8. It's sort of insulting. You know, it doesn't make any sense. It doesn't. The facts don't support it. And that's why I thought at the time, you know, something's not right here. And that's really what made me dive into the story. So to answer the gentleman's question, I think at least 200. I think quite possibly many, many more. It's scary to contemplate. Just you know, it wasn't just 12 hours either. It was really two and a half, three days they went around these mobs killing African Americans. You know, I would put it to any rational person, do the math.
Right. And just the number in my family that were killed, that's 6 or 7 and many more that were wounded. So I would, you know, I would like the state of Texas to go unearth, do a formal investigation, find these mass graves. I have a great uncle, Alex Holly, whose body was never recovered. He deserves a proper burial. I have cousins. Nope. And this, you know, this is something we must do to let them know that their lives are worth seeking justice for. And their bodies themselves deserve more than just to be thrown into a mass grave. So this is my commitment to my ancestors, and I'm not going to stop until I draw my last breath.
And let me interject, Constance, to the gentleman's other question. There were investigations. Unlike the situation in Ferguson, for example, the law enforcement authorities and the judiciary in that area tried to do the right thing. The white sheriff, the white deputies, you know, they fought off or, you know, made mobs stand down to protect African Americans. They arrested, I think, 12 or 13 white men and wound up indicting at least 7. And the judge, Benjamin Gardner, the white judge at the time, tried to prosecute them. They faced obstacles at every turn. Eventually, they did get the 7 indictments, and some of the perpetrators sat in jail. And basically what happened is they waited out, you know, the importance of elections, they waited out the judge's term, you know, essentially, and the sheriff's term and the governor's term. The governor at the time had been a native of that area, and he appointed a special assistant prosecutor. Well, with the new governor, you know, removed the special assistant prosecutor. The new judge was I think he was the nephew, right, Constance, of one of the defense team of the perpetrators, and of course the sheriff. He wasn't reelected. It was political suicide, basically, to do what they did and try to pursue these white folks. Right.
And it was the first time in the state of Texas, in the history of the state of Texas, that white men had been indicted for the murder of black men.
Yeah, I think the case, that's right, Constance, that's exactly right. I think the cases eventually wound up getting transferred to Harrison County, which is Houston, Texas. And at the time, prosecutions... the prosecutor was paid for the successful prosecutions, and he looked at it and he said, yeah, what are the chances we're going to convict these guys, white guys, you know, at a time when only white men were able to serve on this jury. Eventually, the lawyers for the perpetrators got them bail, and it was never pursued after that. And then the final question, how was it covered up? Well, the infrastructure there, you know, of course, was all white. And it was a terribly unpleasant subject for the white folks. And they just bottled it up and didn't talk about it. And to this day, the white folks and a lot of the African Americans there, I think Constance would attest, they don't talk about it either. They don't, you know, it's out of fear, I think, on the African American citizens' side. But on the white folks' side, you know, it's a terrible admission. And it was just kind of forgotten until... you know, a few writers in the last few years uncovered it. And another thing that blew my mind about it, Gus, and Constance, again, I think will attest, you know, the Rosewood Massacre has you know, they've received commemoration. They've received reparations, college funds set up for descendants of the victims. They've even received movie treatment. And only five or six people were killed, and one or two of them were white. And the Tulsa riots, Oklahoma, which I consider, I used to consider a more backward state than Texas, you know, they have put up a commemoration, a memorial, and poured funds into trying to rejuvenate that area, which certainly isn't enough. But I've heard they even have, or trying to set up a college fund for descendants of the victims. Here in Texas, this incident, the Slocum Massacre, was much worse than the Rosewood Massacre, and it equaled or rivaled, if not surpassed, the Tulsa riots, and nothing's been done.
We can't even get a historical marker, the process initiated and proved, to place in the town of Slocum by the state of Texas. And to answer the caller, I think his question was, how can this go? You know, how could there not be an indictment or a prosecution? The same reason why we can't get a white man prosecuted, or it's difficult to get a white man prosecuted in 2014 for the murder of a black man. Imagine what it was like in 1910.
No doubt.
And thank you for those answers. I take up too much time, but I wanted to know about that telegram that was sent to the governor of Texas, and also what started the dispute, or so-called dispute, because I believe it was economic. It was based on economics, and it was a white supremacist move.
Well, I call it economic opportunism. That's certainly one of the theories, and I think there's a lot to that. There were several telegrams actually sent to the governor, some from prominent African-American businessmen. I think W.H. Ellis was one. Some from a group called the Colored Ministers of, well, I think they just called themselves the Union, the Colored Ministers Union. It was 150 African-American ministers in the Washington, D.C. area. They composed a letter actually to President Taft, and they sent telegrams to the governor. Again, the governor tried to do something about this. It's not very successful, but he at least tried. The Taft administration and his Department of Justice was very dismissive about the letters sent by the Colored Ministers Union. I don't know, they kind of treat it like a non-issue. You know, I had to file a Freedom of Information Act to get that information. It had been hidden all these years. The telegrams to the governor were just expressing concern about, you know, what had happened. And they were all from white folks, you know. And one actually was actually a letter from a white man down in Houston County, just south of Anderson County. And he basically said, hey, they're killing black folk for no other reason than the color of their skin. You know, I can't believe this happened here. We should do something about it. He enumerated some other issues they were having, the African-American community. And then at the end, he said, please don't mention who my name, you know, because he feared being assassinated. It was a crazy time, as Constance, you know, notes. I mean, it's bad now, you know, back then. It's horrifying to contemplate.
Did that answer your questions, Mr. Demery, or?
Yes, it did. I just wanted to know about, I believe the records were saying something about a wealthy black businessman and some white owing him money or something to that effect. I just want to know a little bit about that.
Well, that was actually one of Constance's, you know, relatives.
That was my great-grandfather.
Yeah, they said Marsh Holly owed money, or there was a dispute over money with this white citizen named Redden Alford. They also said another relative of Constance's, Abe Wilson, you know, somebody in Houston County tasked him with going around and telling everybody it was time to work on the county roads. And one of the white citizens was offended that a black citizen would be involved in the summons. There were a bunch of different possible origins for the start of the violence. You know, in the end, the Texas politician, Jerry Sadler, said it was all about land. It was simply economic opportunism, and maybe a faux pas here or a misunderstanding or disagreement was trumped up and used to justify trying to do what they wanted to do. You know, some reports suggest, you know, the old, you know, what you hear so much, you know, this sense of Southern chivalry, you know, a black, an African-American man there in the area was flirting with a white woman, or, you know, there was actually a report of a letter where one said he was going to marry one. Back then, miscegenation to white people would have been, you know, unheard of or offensive, and that could have set it off. It's not exactly clear what exactly started it. We're left to speculate.
But the cause of the murder, or the rationale, I believe, in their heads for the murder or the slaughter of the African Americans was because my great grandfather was the wealthiest African American, probably in all of the state of Texas, wealthy, prosperous businessman who is black. He stepped out of his place, so it was an attempt to put him and his sons in their place. So they were not fitting that Southern stereotype of an African American. So he must die. How dare you be wealthy? How dare you be prosperous and black at the same time?
Thank you. Thank you for indulging me. I have a particular interest because I was born and raised in East Texas. And until tonight, I didn't know about Slocum, Texas, but I'm going to learn. And thank you very much. Have a good night.
Appreciate that, Mr. Demery, for the caller at last four digits, 4693. 4693. Did you have a question for our guests, Mr. Bills and or Ms. Joanne?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
I have a question for the, I don't know his name, I forgot, but I wanted to ask him, what motivated him to bring out this information?
Mr. Bills?
I've never been bashful about controversial topics, you know, dating back even to my days as a college journalist. I had been doing a lot of freelance writing around the area, mostly, well, the state of Texas, mostly fluff stuff that would sell. And, you know, I was always interested in topics that were a little more controversial, but that wouldn't sell. And I stumbled across the story of a massacre of Mexican Americans in West Texas, and I'd written that story, and it's a terrible story. It's the Poor Vanir massacre. 18 Mexican Americans were slaughtered in cold blood by the Texas Rangers, killed a whole town, destroyed the town, you know, disappeared after that. But when I was doing the research on that story, that's when I stumbled onto this stuff, to pieces about the Slocum massacre. And again, the more I looked into it, the more it just didn't sit well with me. And I could tell, you know, generally speaking, I don't like to take stories that everybody's written about already or that we already know plenty about. And this one in particular, I saw and I thought, there's really something here. There's something. You know, I think Constance can attest, you know, she's been trying to get the story out of her family as for years and years. There was really something here that was, well, let's just speak plainly, it was offensive. It was offensive to my humanity and humanity in general. You know, it was obvious a cover-up had occurred, you know, in my eyes. It was obvious that, you know, a lie had been perpetrated for over a century. And, you know, the challenge was to where to look. You know, with so many years past, and what was available. And when I first started, I really didn't know how much was available. And, you know, I just wrote an article for it. It was with the Austin American Statesman, Constance said. But the deeper I dug, you know, the more it revealed to me. Any good, you know, research project or a nonfiction book you write, you don't know everything going in. You learn as you go. You learn, and the more you uncover, you know, the more is revealed, you know. And so the deeper I got into this, the farther it stretched out. It wasn't just Slocum, Texas. It was East Texas, you know, in its entirety. You know, the lynchings, the burning folks at the cross, I mean at the stake, all kinds of stuff was going on. And you know what, frankly, again, I was naive. And the more I found out, the more I thought, you know, this story should be told. It should be told.
Okay, I have a second question to ask. Was this in order to stop the economics from rising inside certain sectors of the black community in Texas? And was this, can that be pointed to what happened in those certain parts of Texas to like destroy the economy in black communities?
Well, I think so. What happened in East Texas all those years, and to a large extent, as Gus noted earlier, you know what happened in Jasper? It's terrorism. It's terrorism. My book talks mostly about the Slocum Massacre, but it also talks about the regional context and even the context up into the present day. You know, we howl and we gnash our teeth about terrorism. Well, it's happened in East Texas, and you know, and you know, Gus and Constance may well be right. It may be in America for the last 200 or 300 years. I don't know that I'd argue that, but I can only, you know, speak for my subject now, and that's the East Texas and Slocum. It was terrorism, and yes, it was to hold the, you know, the black folks down. You know, I was telling, you know, Constance and I had a discussion the other day about the African Americans there in East Texas. And you know, I made the comment, you know, racist white folks, they'll always make comments about how African Americans, you know, can't have a successful community, or you go into their neighborhoods and they're all trashed or whatever. You know, they make these disparaging comments. Well, if for the first 40 or 50 or 60 years after the Civil War, anytime the African American community had a successful community, the white folks came in and destroyed it. You know, well, that explains a lot. You know, there was a systemic, you know, regime of disenfranchisement, of terrorism. And, you know, it sort of explains, and I told Constance this also, you know, some of the African Americans in that area in East Texas wouldn't talk to me about this subject. And it got past that I was white. I mean, they were scared. They're still scared in that part of the country. They're still scared to this day. They've been terrorized for over a century. You know, there are public officials there, Constance and I spoke to, that don't want to talk about it out loud. You know, and they don't want trouble stirred up, because stuff has happened and stuff continues to happen. And so, yeah, there's the economic aspect. You know, the white folks say, this is our this is our territory, I guess, so to speak, and yours ain't ours. That definitely goes on. And again, that Texas politician, I didn't say his name, but his name's Jerry Sadler. He said from the very beginning, it was a land grab, you know, an attempt to take over that land. You know, the same land that created, you know, oil barons. I told Constance, I said, sheesh, your great-great-granddad, he might have been the first oil baron if this hadn't happened. So sure, there was an economic.
On the land now, there's nothing but oil wells pumping. And imagine trying to get the state of Texas, oil-rich state of Texas, trying to return oil-rich land. That's our dilemma.
Yep.
All right. I have one last question, and Gus, you can remove me. You can mute me after this. Ever since the beginning of time in this country, you know, white folks have been terrorizing black people and different things like that. And I honestly believe that Jim Crow really hasn't went anywhere. I can see that the phase keep repeating itself, and honestly, I can see through evidence that white folks are never going to change. As the white population go down in America by 2050, do you think that Jim Crow will come back and if not be 10 times worse once whites know that they are going to, once whites find out they are a minority in this country?
Oh, can I jump on that, Constance?
Yeah, but I need to interject. Go ahead.
I just want to say one thing, and everybody's free to disagree. You know, this is a show that's devoted a lot to racism. Let me tell you something. Jim Crow is going to go on, and it's going to get worse, and it's not going to matter the color of your skin. You know, the most dangerous minority in this country are the rich. Jim Crow is going to start applying to the poor whites and the poor blacks, the poor Hispanics. They're the ones that are going to bear the brunt of what's to come.
I can hear you.
I disagree. I believe it was, I was watching a comedy show, and Chris Rock said even the poorest white man wouldn't want to change places with him, a rich black man. So I believe it's more about race than it is about the economic disparity or the, you know, the how we rank it's economically.
That may be true. I'd love to change places that. With Chris Rock.
So it's, and I'm glad you used the word terrorism, ER, and the caller, because it is terrorism against the black man. When the Homeland Security Department was first founded after 9/11, I emailed and contacted them to tell them we need help. It was an SOS to them, you know, for black Americans. We're being terrorized, and still hadn't heard back from them. They're not worried about it. The genocide and the terrorism against the black man. I'm sure somebody read my email and laughed, or saying I'm a nut job. No, I'm not that. This is terrorism, and if your department was created to address terrorism, I need you to address it.
I do see our other caller, the male that just called in. If you can hang tight, if you had another question, I just wanted to make sure I got the next person who got on. I want to try and make sure we cover all the folks who dialed in. I will just point out that CNN, they did a report just last month, urban poverty in black and white, as well as the study that just came out from John Hopkins University. It was on Al Jazeera. It was on NPR. It's been everywhere. I was even thinking we should get the author on, but I was lax about it because he's been all over the place. But these two reports, both of them, showed that it is markedly different being poor and white and being poor and black. It's not the same at all. That you see a huge difference in being a poor white person, just being white. You get access to resources, other white people, economic opportunities, employment opportunities that black people just do not have. Both in the report, I'm looking at it right now, Urban Poverty in Black and White, Carl Alexander and Linda Olson. It was July 11th, 2014, and the... Oh, and he was a Carl Alexander. That was the other person I was thinking of. That's why I say he's been everywhere. That's why I was lax about getting him on the program, because he was on Al Jazeera. He was on NPR. He co-authored this piece at CNN where he had a black male and a white male. They grew up in the same city in Baltimore, Maryland. Both of them were, quote unquote, poor, markedly different outcomes. He even said if you're a black person and you're a white person and you're, quote unquote, poor, if you get some sort of misdemeanor, you're smoking marijuana or some silly low-level nonviolent offense, if you are a white person, you will have a drastically better career life trajectory than being a black person. If you're a black person and you get hit with something like that, you could end up being Michael Brown. If you're a white person,
Gus, I wouldn't argue with that. I mean, I don't disagree with that. I mean, I agree with that totally. But my point is this, okay? Poor white people, you know, even though they have it better, they have more in common with poor black people than they do rich people.
That is not true.
And that's the way they need to look at it.
That's not
true.
Well,
I want to say, as an educator for 20-something years, when I look at my test scores, when they come back, my poor white test scores are more aligned with those of the rich white than my black poor kids. There's a disparity among test results, among reading rates between black poor and white poor. That's because the white poor, the education system sees, quote, the importance of educating that white poor child versus the black poor child.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't argue with that.
Hang on one second, because there's also that same disparity that Ms. Jawade, that she just noted. We had Vernelia Randall on. She's a professor at Dayton University in Ohio. She noted that that exact same disparity exists in healthcare between poor black people and poor white people. And if you continue on up the spectrum, you see the same disparity between rich black people and rich white people. And she said the only conclusion she can come to is that there must be some sort of deficit about being non-white black in a system of white supremacy where you still have an adverse impact on your health, even when they control for everything else, what you eat, exercise, access to good health care, economics. Even when you control for that, you still see that the black people are not in the same position as white people, that is just not true. As I said, that's why I use the term white supremacy. White dominates everything. They constitute a class unto themselves, and they function like that. If you watch, poor white people are not treated the same as poor black people. But I could be, and this is worldwide. I'm not saying this is just something here. This is worldwide where you see this play out all over the globe. But I do want to make sure I get the next caller. Mr. Bills, if you want to respond, I'll give you a chance. I just want to make sure we get all the callers in first. The caller 4223, did you have a question for either our guest, Mr. E.R. Bills, white man, our other guest, Miss Constance Holly Jawade, black female? Did you have a question?
Hello, good evening to the guest and to you, Gus, and Justice. I did come in a little bit late within the program, maybe about 8:27. So this question may have been asked. Please forgive if it was. This question goes toward Mr. Bills. Excuse me. What was your ultimate objective for writing this book?
I briefly touched on it, but not completely. You're a journalist, and your responsibility is not to pat folks on the back necessarily for all the good things that are happening in the world. They almost don't have to be addressed. But if you're a journalist, a serious writer, you consider yourself, you know, an investigator, so to speak, or an investigative journalist, you know, you try to get to the bottom of things. And, you know, in my opinion, you know, it's what's missing from journalism these days. It's your responsibility to uncover injustice, you know, to report injustices, you know, to tell the truth about things. If you're in journalism for any other reason, like, for instance, the whole Fox News channel, then you're in the wrong business. You know, we're protected by the Constitution, the freedom of the press. A virtue unexercised is wasted. You know, journalism is about getting to the bottom of things. And so I stumbled onto the story. I did early, really minimal sort of a perusal of what was out there, and I was shocked by it. And I thought, this story needs to be told. And let me expand just briefly on that. I wrote the article, and honestly, just between you and I thought, this is a black story. You know, I don't know that I should be the one, you know, I mean, I have a problem writing the article, but I thought, there's something here. There's something here that really needs to be uncovered. And after I wrote the original article, I thought, some black graduate student, African-American graduate student, is going to seize on this and do, you know, a book, really try to get to the bottom of it. I thought, it'd be better told, you know, in my mind at the time, I thought. But, you know, several months went by, and a publisher contacted me. You know, it's unheard of. I never, you know, usually you have to go and submit and do all these things. And they contacted me, and they said, we saw this story you wrote, and we were wondering if you'd be interested in doing a book about it. And by that time, I thought, you know, I did another perusal, you know, on the internet, and tried to find out if anybody had seized it and sort of started to run with it, trying to get to the bottom of it. And at that point, still, nobody had really, you know, tried to do anything with it. And I thought, you know what? I can tell this story objectively. I can try to tell the truth about this, you know. So I'm going to go ahead and write the book. And again, it just, if you call yourself a journalist, you know, you try to dig for the truth. You try to uncover, again, injustices. You know, you try to make life you know, a little more fair, make life a little more bearable. You know, you really have a role in society. You know, the failure of the media in recent years, it's a real problem going forward. In this case, you know, I think Constance, you know, might agree. I think I did an honest job, and I did try to get to the bottom of things, you know, and I wrote something that if you read it, you can't tell a white person wrote it, or a black person, or a woman or a man. You know, a human being tried to tell the truth about an atrocity. And that's the story of the book.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for sharing that information. I just had one more, and it'll really quick, and it goes to both Mrs. Jawaid and to you, Mr. Bills. Is it possible for, I caught part of what both you and Mrs. Jawaid were sharing about, you know, suspicion, you know, black people possibly having suspicion when you, you know, first started to put this book together and reach out to them. Is it possible for, you know, a white person like yourself to still go about doing the things that Ms. Jawaid says that, you know, she put you to the test of kind of seeing transparency and improving yourself? Is it possible for a white person to do the things that, you know, prove themselves, et cetera, and still practice racism, white supremacy?
Sure. I think, you know, personally, I think it's possible. I think, you know, talking to Constance, I think I probably revealed I might even have been racist. In ways I didn't know I was. I like to think I'm pretty informed. And even Gus's, you know, the title of Gus's, you know, show, you know, struck me. And it didn't strike me as a human being. You know, it says white supremacy. You know, we all have baggage. We all have, you know, a place we came from. And even though I was incredibly lucky to not be raised by racists and to not be debilitated by the crippling baggage of racism, I grew up at an all-white school. I think there was one African-American kid. I mean, I grew up privileged, and I grew up around, frankly, a lot of racist people. And there's no... I had to transcend some of it, but, you know, even today, I'm not a finished product. I don't think Gus is, and I don't think Constance is. Any of us are. We learn more every day, and again, in a brief conversation with Constance the other day, you know, I may still have some baggage I don't know about, but in the case of
I'll
this
help
book,
you with it.
Yeah, yeah. In the case of this book, I really, I didn't play favorites. I did not cut the white folks any slack. And, you know, I think we're capable of that. You know, Spike Lee famously said, you know, that white directors or white writers shouldn't try to portray African-Americans because they have no way of understanding what it's like. And, you know, I respect Spike Lee, and I'm a huge fan. But you know what? I think the imagination, black or white, is more powerful than that. A person's ability to empathize, it's more powerful than that. And I think Spike Lee, even though he's black, he can convey white people very, very forcefully. And I think, you know, anybody with a really good imagination can get their head around the situation, as terrible as it may seem. And in this case, I just happen to be the white guy who wrote the book. But I don't think it's filtered. I don't think I tried to pull any punches. If anything, I was probably harder on the white folks in this situation, than I might have been on the African Americans, because they were the perpetrators, they were the terrorists, you know, they were the monsters, they were the monstrosity, and that's the way the book needed to be recorded, in my opinion. I think Constance could speak to that.
I agree. I believe you were very neutral, and you reported the facts.
You also, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And to answer your question, yes, I do believe they can still be racist or support the myth of white supremacy. I think racism, one definition that I use, is just a privileged people doing whatever it takes to sustain or maintain that privileged status. And that's racism. That's the cause of, I don't want to lose this position of entitlement. I don't want to lose this privileged status. So I am going to do whatever it takes to ensure that my kids get to enjoy this status of privilege, even at the expense of your children being oppressed.
Yeah, and caller, I will say this. As far as your question, I think the case is being made right now on this show. You know, there's an implication on this show right now that I don't completely get it, that I'm at least partially racist, even though I wrote this book.
What? Okay, this is the last, really. Partially racist, what does that mean?
Well, I mean, obviously I wrote the book. I'm not, a spittle-casting, Confederate flag-wearing NASCAR fan, here. We're not seeing things exactly the same in terms of genocide and in terms of, my statement that the white poor have more in common with the black poor. Obviously, we're not seeing things the same. And sort of the underlying suggestion is that I don't completely get it still, even though I wrote this book. I don't think that Gus or even Constance would deny that, would you?
I would deny that. Excuse me.
Yeah.
You can give your own response, Mr. Wade, but I would deny that unambiguously.
I don't think, are you saying, ER, that we think you are or could be a racist or have racist tendencies?
I said,
because
I don't know, Constance, I don't, I don't think you're,
no,
you think
that's
I'm a racist.
Not the case. We disagree on poverty and wealth. And,
yeah.
But, no,
but also,
I don't.
But also genocide, and why would I, certainly, and I'm not saying you guys are accusing me of it. It's nothing that's open, but I think there's a suggestion. I think it's suggested by the answers. If you're on the outside listening, I think there's a suggestion of that. There has to be. I mean, how could I not? But anyway, it doesn't matter. Going forward, I mean, I'm not offended by it, and I've already, confessed that, I may have some racist baggage. I am the white guy. I did grow up with white privilege. I certainly try not to, but it might be, everything, escaping all of it. I don't know. I can't answer to it. And I'm not condemning anybody or criticizing anybody even, but I just, there's almost a suggestion, and right quick before I forget, back to the statement of the poor, that's the way white poor need to look at it. You can argue what the facts are. I don't care what the facts are. I understand that white folks are more privileged on every level and in every stratus. I understand that. But in my opinion, that's how poor white folks should look at it. Howard Zinn suggested that early on in his People History of the United States. What really scared the slave-owning, aristocracy was not black rebellion alone, but there were cases where indentured white servants, got together actually and conspired with slaves. And that terrified the slave-owning gentry more than anything. You want to start a revolution? Get the poor white folks and the poor black folks on the same side. You'll see some changes.
The female caller, did you answer your question, or were you satisfied?
Yes, thank you both for answering my questions, and thank you, Gus, for taking my call.
Appreciate that. Any of the other folks that are listening in, if you have questions either for Mr. Bills or Ms. Wade, you should get your hand up now. Don't lollygag. Wait till the last minute. Go ahead and get your hand up if you have a question. I just want to make sure I clarify my responds. Before I do, I will say, particularly since Spike Lee was just on TV and he said, in the last 7 days, I think there is a war being waged against black people in response to what was happening in Ferguson. And I agree with that. And I would also agree with his assessment about white filmmakers, particularly if the product that we're going to end up with is The Help, then I would agree emphatically that I would much rather have black people doing films on Rosewood or Jackie Robinson or something like what your book is focused on. My response to your kind of final commentary there, when you said that perhaps in some of the responses that myself, Mr. Wade have offered during the broadcast this evening, suggest, imply that you might be racist or at minimum that you, quote unquote, don't get it with regards to how the system of racism, white supremacy works, how black people are being terrorized and genocided. And I said, I deny that. I do not take the position that the problem is that white people are ignorant, including yourself. You've written a very detailed book about racism and not just acutely on this incident in 1910 with regards to what happened to probably dozens of black people, if not hundreds of black people in Slocum, Texas, but the continued acts of racism where white people fabricated this event, minimized it, wouldn't talk about it, denied it. In my view, that is continued racism. So I do not take the position that you are ignorant or that you do not understand it. I take the position that individuals like yourself, white people, they are very informed about racism. The problem is not ignorance, and the problem is not that any group of white people, that they do not ally with black people. The problem is that we do not have an accurate understanding of what it means to be white and how this system of racism, white supremacy, remains in place generation after generation after generation. I take the position that we do not have proper understanding of that. We do not have proper suspicion of white people based on the long, undeniable record of terrorism that they have wreaked on non-white people all over the world. Now, even some of the things that you just shared about you, quote unquote, not getting it. Again, as I said, I don't agree with that. And you bringing up the class point, I hear many black people say that that's the problem. Kanye West, he says that almost every time he's on television now, that it's not about race, it's about class. I hear many, many black and non-white people say that. I do not agree. Just because I don't agree with someone doesn't, or it shouldn't, suggest that there's some implication that that person is racist. In fact, I would say that that to me is more telling that you shared, you commented that us having a disagreement about whether or not genocide is being waged against black people and poor white people, whether they do or whether they should ally themselves with black people, you saying that that implies or suggests that you are racist, I would say it tells more about you than me, because I don't think anybody here said that you're racist. I didn't even say that you were a racist suspect, which I have done pretty regularly. When I talk to white people, I have no problem telling them that I think you are deliberately practicing racism and have done so many times live on the program, or that I suspect you could be practicing racism. I didn't say that at any point during the program. I just gave my opinion on different questions. If you have a different opinion or a different perspective, that is fine. That's, you know, we're having an exchange of views. I'm sure if Mr. Wade and I talked long enough, there'd be many things that we don't agree on. That's fine, too.
Right.
But to immediately jump to that somehow implies or suggests that you are racist, if anything, that would send a red flag up to me about, I think the phrase that I've heard some people use, your whiteness is showing, because nobody here said that you're racist. That just to me is very strange. I hope that stuck out for listeners. And if you've been listening to the whole program, nobody here said or suggested, implied that you were racist. I think we were having pretty calm discussion. Nobody got riled up or excited or anything. And we're really just looking to get more information about your book. I'll let Ms. Jouet jump in. I just want to make sure I got in one other comment. You said yourself, and this is the other thing, because some of the things that you've said, these are patterns. These are things that I observe from white people repeatedly. And when I see these behaviors, things that white people say or the way that they conduct themselves in conversations on racism, it makes me think, it makes me suspicious to think maybe this white person is racist, because you sound like many of the other white people that I've talked to. To say,
hey, Gus, can I cut you off for a second?
No, hang on 1 second. You said that you have some racist baggage. You said that you grew up around racists. If that's correct, if that's accurate, if you've been truthful with us, it would be logical, it would be reasonable for us to suspect you of being racist. You just said that, not even 5 minutes ago, that you have some baggage that you're still working on as a white man, as a privileged white man in a system of white supremacy, even though you don't like that term. Fine, if that's the case, there should be some suspicion. There shouldn't be anything incorrect about that. It should be, yeah, you said yourself, the black people that were suspicious, including Ms. Jawade, that she was suspicious when you first came to talk to her, and so were some of the other black people, that should exist. So if it came up during the discussion of this evening, I would say kudos to all of the non-white people if that was the case. But again, nobody said that. Nobody said, we suspect you of being racist, we think you're a racist, or what you just said sounds like something a racist would say. Nobody even said that. So I just find that very profound. I am suspicious because you are a white person. I am suspicious that you probably could be a racist. And that's just default with me until this problem has been corrected. I don't think that's crazy. I think that's very logical based on the evidence even that you lay out in your book and what you shared with us. I'll get Ms. Jawade. I hope that was not confusing. I hope I made sense if I was talking crazy.
No, you made sense. We just disagreed on the topic of classism, not racism. And because you don't agree with my view of classism, does not make you a racist. Two different topics.
No, I have no problem with that. My question was going to be, who brought up the idea that someone might have written a book like this and still be racist?
I think one of the callers.
Calling in, only thing they know is you're a white guy. So you haven't, I know it's unfair, but you haven't proven yourself to them, and they're trying through this discourse get to know who you are. And I think that's where she was going. She wasn't making any accusations, but she was trying to see your stance, your position, and your motive, if there was one.
No, and I'm not offended. It's all good.
Good.
Your commentary earlier didn't suggest that it was all good. Your commentary earlier suggested some defensiveness or that there was maybe even something incorrect about there being a suggestion or implication that you could be a racist. And even when you finished all that, you said it wasn't that big a deal. In my mind, I was thinking if it wasn't that big a deal, you spent quite a bit of time kind of making that point that there had been some implications that you might be a racist. And I think that's important, particularly when you have a white person who concedes they have some quote unquote baggage, that they have some racism that they're probably still working through. I see that too many times from white people where it just can't be, hey, I'm white. This is a system of racism, white supremacy. You're absolutely totally correct to think of me as racist, and you might even be right. I don't hear that enough from white people. It's just way too much defensiveness, and you shouldn't think of me as racist. I did want to ask a few more questions about the book before we run out of time. I wanted to get, and I see we got callers too. I'll try and pick out the most important question that I can come up with. Ooh. I'll get it in before we ride. Number one, the hysteria. And I think this is so important because of, contemporary events where you have all of these unarmed, black people, being beaten to death, as Marlene Pinnock out in California, beaten by the highway patrolman, and obviously with Michael Brown and Eric Garner and Ezell Ford, and you just name all these unarmed black people, where you have this hysteria, this fear that this black person was a threat, that they possibly could have done harm, possibly could have even killed me as a white person. And that theme is in your book as well, with regards to what the motivating force behind the Slocum Massacre was, this event of white terrorism. This is on page 13 of your book, where you write, this is from the Dallas Morning News, that the third and the most serious reason, which is believed to be directly responsible for the tragedies, is the seemingly baseless and unfounded wild reports and rumors which gained currency and which were magnified as they were repeated from mouth to mouth, these were to the effect that the Negroes were preparing to rise and kill all the white people. This was reported August 1, 1910, and then a little bit further down the page, you write that the calls for help brought white reinforcements from all over Anderson County. It seemed to be a summons for which a number of citizens had been waiting. I thought that was important, too, because that seems to be a pretty consistent pattern in a lot of these events, even all the way up to 2005 in Hurricane Katrina and the breach of the levees. They reported all this about same thing, armed black people running amok, raping babies and looting. They did not report as much that you had a lot of black people who were shot and killed, some by white police officers in Louisiana. But the same thing where you had white people coming from all over the state to participate in killing black people. And most of those people were never convicted, never charged, never indicted. I just wanted to get your comment on this consistent theme of armed black people coming to run amok and brutalize white people, and how that played out in terms of what happened with these events and even that current rallying cry even being used to justify killing these unarmed black people that we've been hearing about the last month or so.
Well, address the past or present or both?
Both would be grand.
Okay. Well, as I'm sure you know, Gus, I know Constance knows, on July 4th or 5th, 1910, Jack Johnson won the World Heavyweight title. Nowhere in the South, and actually not in most places in the country, were pictures of that fight even allowed to be displayed. The entire white population just wanted to pretend like it didn't even happen. But, you know, white folks were obviously not happy about it. And that happened on July 5th. You had the Holly family, which Constance, you know, eloquently, you know, described. They were prosperous. They were wealthy. They were really upstanding citizens of the community. Abe Wilson, Jack Holly, respected by almost all, you know. But having wealth in that day and time was enough to start a lynching for looking like you were better off than white folk. An example of some African-American upward mobility was offensive to many white people. Jack Johnson winning the heavyweight championship was offensive to white people. It seemed like folks were standing around waiting for something like this to happen. And you know what? Again, what I said earlier about the column I wrote in Fort Worth Weekly, you know, just the other day, it appears to me, you know, white folks are frustrated about the direction of the country, about a black president, and they're standing around with guns. They're going to the store with guns. They're buying more guns and finding ways to blame our black president for everything. It seems to me their match is waiting for a strike. You know, it seems like that kind of atmosphere. And I think it's happened again and again, you know, throughout American history, sad to say. And it's happened today. The only difference I would say in the difference between Slocum and what's happening in Ferguson in New York in the Garner case, you know, the white police were trying to do the white thing. Or sorry, the white thing. Wow. Freudian slip. the white police, the white judge, they were trying to do the right thing. And it was the population that was basically run amok. And, you know, in the case of Ferguson, and I think in the case of Garner in New York, what happened to him, I'm not convinced the police or the judge are trying to do the right thing, you know, or the judiciary in either case. And it's upsetting. It's frustrating. Slocum, same kind of stuff, worse stuff probably going on, but wildly or unimaginably, you know, the police and the judiciary were trying to do the right thing. Didn't get very far. But anyway, I hope that answered your question.
Mr. Wade, did you want to comment just on that? Unless I'm misunderstanding, to me, it just seems like a continuum with the rallying cry being that, oh, my goodness, these Negroes are armed and they're coming to attack white people. We need to defend ourselves. Let's go out and just start shooting the first black person we see. And this, to me, it just seems very consistent with these unarmed black people being shot, beaten, arrested under the pretext that they were a threat. They were violent. They were aggressive. They were going to do bodily harm. They were going to violently attack us. So we had to defend ourselves by shooting them 41 times, 25 times, 10 times, whatever the case may be. Did you have a comment on that? Or
I agree. It's more the same. Nothing has changed. And this is why I teach my children their history. There's a saying that those who forget their history are destined to repeat it. And because history has been rewritten or just forgotten, we're suffering the consequences of that, which is repeating it. This started way back when, and because we are not recognizing it, addressing it, or forgetting it altogether, it's cyclical. We're repeating it in 2014, and it's not going to change until we address it.
Mm-hmm. The caller, I want to make sure I don't miss any folks who had a question. The caller at 9495. Did you have a question for either Mr. Bills or Ms. Jawade?
I have a lot of things for both of them and for you too. Constance, it's nice to finally hear your voice. This is Calvin. First.
Hi.
First, the one thing that I think that happens a lot in these conversations is when we use the phrase whites or blacks. I think the first thing we ought to say is some whites or some blacks. Because when you just say white folks or whites, you're saying all in general or all of them are racist. And I no longer believe that. I believe some are racist and racism still exists. But we have to be careful how we phrase it because then we might upset someone like the writer of this book. I think his name was Bill. So we have to be careful when we start saying blacks or we start saying whites. We should say some whites. I think the one other comment was that about helping to carry each other's baggage. I think that's what we have to do to end racism. You know, we have to begin to help carry each other's baggages, and we have to recognize the evil that people are doing. I think earlier in the conversation, someone sent out a telegram when the massacre was happening. Did I hear that right? Someone sent out a telegram. And I imagine this person was a white person. So how could we just say whites are racist or whites? Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Gus, go ahead.
Can I ask first, are you a black person, non-white person, white person?
Well, that's a tough question to ask or explain, because one thing I do understand is when when people started getting classed as blacks or whites.
Hang on a second, sir. I'm just trying to fast forward. If you have a driver's license, I'm sure you filled out forms before. You've had to give your racial classification. What's on your driver's license? That's all I'm asking.
I understand your question. Now, please understand my explanation.
I can't. I mean, hang on.
Yes or no.
I have a mute button. My mute button works. This is going to be real cut
and dry. If you want to mute me, I could just hang up.
That's fine too. Because I just need a quick answer to that question.
That's what I'm saying.
I'm going to mute your question. I'm going to mute your line if I don't get a quick classification.
I'll save you the mute.
That's fine. Thank you. And for anybody who listens to the program, I don't have a whole lot of taking 30 minutes for something that's that simple. If you are over 18 years of age, you have filled out a form where you have had to list your racial classification. It's very simple. It's not something that we need to spend an hour discussing what I am and this, that, and the other. What's on your driver's license? It's very simple. And I know for a lot of it, but I'm particularly talking to non-white people, we get very confused about racial classifications. That is one of the highest on my list. I asked Mr. Bills that question when he came on the program. That was one of the first questions I asked him. We didn't take 30 minutes on that. He said, I'm a white man, and we moved right forward. That's the way it should be. I just don't have an hour, 5 days to do a symposium on a simple question. What is your racial classification? What is on your driver's license? That does not require an 8-page essay. It's very simple. And, you know, I know a lot of people are confused on that some days. I can spend more time being patient, but we got two guests and I have questions and other folks have questions. I just don't have all that time to get into that. The other part of the comment that he made about some whites and all that, I do not subscribe to that because I've just come to a conclusion. As I said, we need to have a little bit more clarity and honesty about what it means to be a white person. I am very comfortable classifying white people collectively on the basis of their record, their history, their undeniable conduct worldwide, because I'm not just talking about white people in the United States. We've had white people on this program from Australia, New Zealand, France, the United Kingdom, and it has been the exact same thing with regards to their reporting, what they have witnessed, what they have done with regards to how black people are treated. So that's fine. We don't have to agree. I'm very comfortable classifying white people collectively. I don't feel the need to speak in a manner that's not going to upset white people. Many white people are upset the moment that you begin to mention racism as a problem. So I don't worry about people getting upset about what I'm going to say, white people or non-white people. And I'm very comfortable classifying white people collectively on the basis of their conduct. Most of the white people that I have talked to understand that pretty much that's true. It's shameful. It's disgraceful. But the record speaks for itself. All you have to do is go to the history books and analyze their conduct worldwide. The comment I will get to, my own question, I don't want to take up you all's entire evening. I guess I will have to ask for Mr. Bills because this comes up all the time on the program. Sexual intercourse between white people and non-white people. That's a core element of the book that you write about with Jack Johnson, talking about that might have been because people there just is not clarity with regards to what started this incident of white terrorism in Slocum 1910. Jack Johnson, black heavyweight champion, first black heavyweight champion. A lot of white people were very upset about that and the fact that he was having sexual intercourse with many white women, were furious about that. He ultimately was placed in jail for having sexual intercourse with a white woman. This has been a consistent theme with regards to many black people being lynched, entire towns burned down. You talk about that with Rosewood, even Tulsa, a black person, unless I've been misinformed, that's how all of that started in Tulsa, Oklahoma. A black person bumped into a white woman on an elevator and things kind of sparked from there. This is something we talk about on the program all the time. Eighth area of people activity, sexual intercourse. Do you think white people and non-white people having sexual intercourse, do you think that that will help to solve this problem, racism, white supremacy?
Who was that question for?
Mr. Bills.
Hello?
Oh, I can hear you, Ms. Jawade. That question was for Mr. Bills. Mr. Bills?
Yeah.
Oh, are you with us, Mr. Bills? I'm not not here. I don't know if you hit your mute button. Or...
Let me... His phone... Maybe his phone died. I don't know.
Checking my mail, see if he listed in. That is... I might even have to... Yeah, that would be fascinating if his phone dipped out on that one, because that is very important. It's a huge theme in his book. I'm not, you know, making this up. Mr. Wade, you've read his book. Is this a big theme in his book? Black people, particularly black males having sexual intercourse or rumored to have looked at a white woman or wanted to think about a white woman. That's a big element in what he talks about in his book, correct?
Correct. Mm. And the person he talks about in the book is my great-grand-uncle.
Wow.
That was rumored to have liked a white woman. His name is Les Colley, there in the book. And that is the white man's prized possession, is his white woman. And how dare you, Les, look at or think about this white woman, my possession. Mm. And you're punished for that. And many black in the South, especially, I'm from the South, I know for a fact many were lynched here in Texas for just looking in the direction of the white man's most precious possession.
Mm. I wanted to hear from Mr. Bills, but I given that rich history that you just offered, do you think, because that's something I hear all the time, that racism either is over or is very close to being defeated because you have so many what they call interracial relationships and white people marrying black people and other non-white people. So certainly racism is out the door. Do you think that
makes sense? That's ridiculous. They said that when Obama became president. Is this the end of racism? No, it's going to exacerbate the races that exist in this country. It's going to worsen it and make them step up their acts of racism when they see an interracial couple, when there is a black elected official. It's not going to end it, by no means. It will do the polar opposite.
Wow. Refreshing. I'm reminded of Texas, Mac Strong. I don't know if you all are A&M fans or if you all even care about football, but the new head football coach at Texas A&M is a black male, Mac Strong. Before he was hired at Texas A&M, apparently he had been an assistant coach for a number of years and successful programs, had won championships and what have you. He said he was told explicitly, because he is married to a white woman, he would not be a head football coach because that would upset a lot of white people and they would not want to have their head football coach, particularly at a big institution like Texas A&M or some of the other big schools. They would not want a black head football coach who is married to a white woman. And this is something that was reported not, you know, 1950 or 19. This was end of 2013, very beginning of 2014 when this was reported. He's still married to a white woman. He's at Texas A&M now. But that is, I would say, keep an eye on that, you know, over the course of it.
I agree. You can't do that. Now, we can sleep with your women, but you better not even think about sleeping with our women. Movies where, like, Monster's Ball with Holly Berry, I think that was the name of the movie.
Yes, ma'am.
Had that been a black man that slept with a white woman, he wouldn't have been up for an Academy Award. She wouldn't have won for sleeping with a black man.
Particularly where the black male killed her white husband and then hooked up with her after the fact. That that film wouldn't even have been made.
It wouldn't have showed in theaters. Would have went straight to DVD.
Amen. I wanted to get the, because I hear that all the time where people present that argument. And to me, it's ludicrous. It makes no sense at all. And I frequently cite, if that were the case, if all we needed to do was integrate the bedroom, so to speak, we would not be having this program right now. This problem would have been taken care of. Go ahead.
Because there are different, the bedroom has been integrated by force for hundreds of years. I had my DNA done last year, and it came back 24% European, and it broke down the European. That's proof that the bedroom has been integrated. That's also a sign that there was a crime that has been committed. My DNA is proof of a crime, of a rape of a black woman, because there were no black men that married white men in my family. And then if that would end racism, when they slept with or raped my black female ancestors, how did that end racism? It didn't, and it won't, and it won't. Like I said, it will exacerbate it. If that made sense.
Totally. Crystal clear. In fact, Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, I don't know if you're familiar with her work or not. She wrote the ISIS papers. She was
I am.
She was a guest on the program yesterday. She said the exact same thing. She said that she thinks that there is likely a correlation between the increase in these quote unquote interracial relationships, particularly black males with white women, and all of these shootings that have been occurring. Almost kind of what Mr. Bills was saying about, you have a lot of white males particularly who are very frustrated, and that's how they're taking it out on the Eric Garners and Michael Brown Jr. and Ezell Ford and John Crawford and blah, 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 blah. Even what happened, as I said, with Marlene Pinnock and the black family that was in Texas. This was just a couple days ago where they pulled this black female over. She had her children in the car with her at gunpoint.
That was here in Dallas County.
Oh, okay. Exactly, exactly. She said that she thinks that is because they are upset about all of these white women being in bed with black males or non-white males in general, and that's how they're taking it out in some segments. And or President Obama, we can't get at him, so we'll take it out on you. We have access to you.
Right. Wow. Right. And a lot of innocent black men are prosecuted because any black man will do. Mm. A lot of innocent black men are on death row. It doesn't matter if we have the wrong one. Anyone will do. One public hanging, and maybe the rest of them will get in line and act right.
Absolutely.
We let him lay in that in the ground in Ferguson, Missouri, that long. That sent a message. Back during slavery, once they hung a black man, they didn't take him right down. They let him hang there to send a message. That baby laid in the street in Ferguson, Missouri, as long as he did, to send a message to other blacks in the community. This, too, could be you. Again, that is my opinion.
I'm in 5,000% agreement. Just what message do you think it sends, or do you even think it sends a message with the killer in this case, Officer Darren Wilson, racist suspect, where he has, and I haven't looked today, so who knows where it is, but the last time I checked was yesterday evening. He has raised almost $500,000 in support from white people who say that they are with him and they think what he did was justified, and that he has been, quote unquote, tarred in the press and painted as some sort of villain for carrying out his duties as an enforcement official. And a lot of the people that have donated, well, you have the Klan, they're fundraising for him. That's one. But then a lot of the white people who have donated, they made so many racist comments on the GoFundMe website that they had to turn the comments off because of what they were saying about black people and Michael Brown. What message do you think that conveys?
To the white individual, to the murderer?
Just to the public at large, to black people, or even to white people.
I think it sends a message that no matter how much you march, how much you protest, we know you're going to stop. And we, too, are a force. We are an economic force. Mm-hmm. We're not marching to support him. We're putting money in the bank. We're going to make sure he's okay. The same thing happened to Zimmerman in Florida, if you remember. Mm-hmm. He had a defense fund set up for him, and there were donations being made left and right. And then afterwards, he, you know, all kind of book deals, or he was going to fight someone and get $50,000 for a white, fighting someone. He's white, and it just sends a message that we have your back, white man, and Negro, don't try it. Don't think about trying it. Mm-hmm. You will be met with an economic force and even a physical force if you try to stand up against the establishment. Mm-hmm. So we're going to march, but what are we going to do once we stop marching? When the cameras turn off, we have to make sure our voices are heard. We have to pull our money, just in the way in which whites pull their money to defend a cause which they strongly support. We need to pull our money to support causes that have our best interest at heart. We have to put our money where our mouth is and where our interests are. And that only happens when you pull together economically, like my great-grandfather did in Slocum, to better not only himself but the black community. So.
Amen. Amen. Could not agree more. We didn't want to pull your whole evening. I'll just double-check to see if any of callers, if everybody, I don't know if you all are straight, or do you all have a final question for Mr. Wade? I'm not sure what happened to Mr. Bills, if he had some phone problems or what happened, but is everybody good, or did anyone have a quick final question for Mr. Wade?
Well, thank you for having me on the show, Gus.
Oh, it was a privilege. I'm so glad that you were able to hang out with us. I'm kind of stunned that they allowed you to be a principal, given the views that you have. But wow.
In my last assignment, I was principal at a school that was about 50% white, 40% black, 10% Hispanic. And the white superintendent told me, I'm 6 foot tall, slightly over, that I was frightening my white parents just with my presence. And if I smiled more, they would think I'd be more approachable.
Wow.
You know, I can't apologize for being a 6 foot tall black woman. That's who I am. And if you, as a 5 foot two white woman, are frightened by me, that's on you. There's nothing, I'm not even going to go to bed and pray to God to make me a 5 foot two white woman. I am a 6 foot tall black woman, and it is what it is. And it's, you know, so that's the kind of system we have here in Texas. We have superintendents who have the audacity to come and tell me, you know, and he suggested that I seat myself when I talk to them.
Wow.
So they won't feel as threatened. So they won't have to look up at me. But
wow.
It's a battle every day, and I prepare for it daily.
That is incredible. I'm not surprised, but wow. To ask you to take a seat. Wow.
To have a seat, though I would appear less threatening, because he had received calls that I was not approachable. Okay.
Wow. It's incredible. That is the world. And that's what I mean about genocide. I mean, when we're talking about it's that things that are that, I mean, I would want to say silly and tacky, really, that just you having to be, the creator blessed you by being tall. And that is a problem. And it goes back to what we were saying earlier. About
what?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. That somehow you are a threat. Somehow it doesn't matter. You don't have to have a weapon. Just having melanin and your presence is a threat. And it makes us uncomfortable, and we might even have to resort to violence in dealing with you just because you are black and you're here. I mean, that. Wow. Wow. We talk about school issues all the time. It I know some of our, myself and many of our listeners, we would love to, if you would like to come back and just kind of talk about some of the things you've observed in the school system through the years, your experience.
I sure would.
Oh, fantastic.
I sure would. I'll email you all of my contact information.
Wonderful. Wonderful. I'm so thankful that you can hang out with us this evening. It really was a treat hearing from you. I'm sure our listeners did as well. And we definitely, I just wish you the best in continuing to inform people about what happened with your family at Slocum and taking excellent care of yourself and your offspring. We definitely look forward to having you back on the program soon.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
For sure.
And we'll be talking soon.
Absolutely. Have a fantastic evening. We'll talk soon.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Bye.
Goodbye. Context of white supremacy. Wow. I feel like I've heard an anecdote like that before. I feel like I have to think about it. Maybe I can recall before we go off the air, but I feel like I heard that from somebody before where they had to appease a white person just for being tall, where they had to sit down, or a white person made some sort of just outlandish, tacky request like that. Just because you are a black person and tall or what have you, and they feel intimidated or frightened by your presence. That is, wow. Wow. Again, I have no idea what happened to Mr. Bills. I've been looking on the switchboard to see if I missed him. I think I had the number correct. I have no idea what happened to him. I will highlight that he vanished on us at the point where the sexual intercourse question came up, and I've said consistently that is huge on the program. I've said that over and over and over again. It's a huge aspect of his book that we didn't get to touch on, but that was rumored to be one of the possible causes for this massacre taking place in the first place, white terrorism, that a black male might have been wanted to be involved with a white woman. But I thought that was very important. I was looking forward to hearing his response on that. That too, I'll get that on the record. That too might have been an act of racism on the part of Mr. Bills departing before that question could be answered. I don't know for sure, but that would be my suspicion. I will get our commercial in, and then if any folks have any comments they want to make before we wrap up. If you feel I was incorrect, the caller that dialed in who I guess, would not or wanted to give a very, it seemed to me, lengthy commentary on his racial classification. If you feel that was incorrect, if I should have let him give his commentary, you can let that be known as well. I thought I had logical reasons for not wanting to endure that sort of long and really drawn out answer to a question that should be, you know, very concise, 3 seconds or less. But at any rate, you can let me know if I was incorrect there. Again, we'll play the commercial. And in fact, because I do have the audio of the black female that was stopped, she said in Fort Worth just past couple days, as a black mom, she was stopped with her children in the vehicle. White officers pulled them out, handcuffed her, and made her exit the vehicle at gunpoint. And it turns out not only did they not have the correct people, they didn't even have the right make of the vehicle. The audio report that I have, it's also interesting because they have four news anchors. I generally don't see that many commentators, but it's four news anchors. It's a black female, a black male, a white male, and a white female. The black male doesn't say anything. It's the other three newscasters. They're the only ones that are speaking. It's to the very end when the black male speaks up and makes a comment about, you know, what this situation made him think about. I thought that was fascinating as well. So just keep that in mind. I'll play the clip and then we'll have time if anybody has any comments they want to get in before we wrap things up. Context of white supremacy. We will be right back.
All right. Imagine this. You're driving with your kids when suddenly police pull you over, and before you know it, you're being handcuffed at gunpoint.
I know. That is a crazy story. And that's exactly what happened to a Texas mother. And officers say it was all a case of mistaken identity.
Oh, boy.
This morning, we've got hands on the chilling video.
Driver, let me see your hands. Everybody stick their hands out the window.
So how did this happen? Officers say they got a 911 call of a driver speeding down the highway waving a gun. So they pulled over Kimitra Barber's car thinking she was the suspect. In less than a minute, though, they realized they got the wrong car, but by that time, the kids were freaking out.
It's okay.
No, everything's fine.
No, no one's going to jail.
Everything's fine.
Everything's fine. Hey, stop crying. It's okay.
It doesn't. You can't just say, okay, I'm sorry, and then I'm over it. I can't. I mean, every time I listen to or hear or think about it, it bothers you.
What's even more confusing about all this is Barbara drives a burgundy Nissan, and the 911 call said the suspect was in a tan Toyota, making it even more unclear why police pulled her over. But hearing those kids crying is very bothersome.
That is terrible. Those poor kids were clearly traumatized.
Can you imagine sticking a gun in their face?
That is bad. That is
really bad.
Yeah.
Doesn't match. Yeah, there's going to be something happening.
I had the same thing happen to me on my way down here to work in Tennessee.
Did you really?
Yeah. I had my stuff in the back, you know, because I was driving here to move here to go to work. And in Tennessee, I was pulled over. Mistaken identity. But they did pull me out and everything.
Gunpoint?
Not gunpoint, per se. But they had their hands, you know.
Yeah.
And were you like, wow, welcome to the South?
I sounded like the kid. I was, no. I was like, whoa, what did I do? So I understand, kind of. But I know with the kids, that would be even
That's
worse.
Terrible. Yeah.
Context of white supremacy. The video to that might even be worth watching to see the performance that the white woman put on, racist suspect. Her acting as though she was so concerned and all shook up about all this. Just, yeah. Anywho, the male caller who dialed in who could not or would not give us a concise racial classification, he had asked about the problem is that we all need to help each other carry our baggage. And I just heard that. Metaphors. Really be mindful of the metaphors that people use when talking about racism, white supremacy. Just try and be explicit about what we're saying. The other thing that popped in my mind immediately is don't help white people. Say that on the program all the time. Don't help white people. I'm certainly not helping white people carry their quote unquote baggage as it relates to racism. I don't see white people helping black people. I see black people getting gunned down in the street and snatched by enforcement officials and bludgeoned to death on the side of the highway. That's what I see. I don't see white people helping black people. I see white people raising $40 million plus for the Ice Bucket Challenge. And I see white people raising nearly $500,000 for a white killer police officer, Darren Wilson. I don't see them with that same sort of gusto to help black people. I just see them terrorizing black people. So, yeah, I don't, that, again, metaphors. But again, you know, if folks feel that I was incorrect or could have handled that better, you can definitely let me know so we can make improvements there. But, you know, I just go again, racial classification confusion. And I suspect there will probably be more of that with non-white people. And I even think that some white people are going to be doing that to get away from just saying that I'm a white person in a discussion of racism, where they're trying to say, oh, well, I have, you know, Cherokee grandmother and Stephen Fedget was my great cousin and blah, 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 to just try and get you off in some confusion. But increasing numbers of non-white people where, well, you know, the same thing. I check white and I check Latino and Hispanic and black and Pacific Islander and all this. What's on your driver's license? This should not take 5 hours. I heard Mr. Fuller say that you see non-white people with racial classification confusion where we go to fill out a form, whether it's the census or a driver's license, any other form, and we're sitting in there for 8 hours. You know, did Aunt Lucy, was she part Indian? And I think my other cousin, I think they came from Germany. And I think some of our great, great, great grandfathers, I think they might be Irish. And the white person comes in 30 seconds, I'm white, click and gone. I mean, get out of the confusion mode, get out of the confusion mode, really just try and get some clarity about racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, what it means to be a white person. Did any of the folks who dialed in have any comments they wanted to get in before we wrap up, what they heard from the guests, or if Gus was acting a fool, talking crazy, you can get that in too.
Helen, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
No comment, additional comments besides this one I'm about to make. I think this was an excellent show, program tonight. That's pretty much it. I'm still learning, but I really think this was an excellent program, observing Mr. Bills, some of his reaction also. Was kind of telling for me. So thank you.
For sure. Appreciate it. You participate enough. I'm trying to, I'm very uncouth, cantankerous, I was told yesterday, so I don't do all the socialness that I should. You chime in enough. How do you want to be referenced on the program so we can have a handle for you?
Sure. Let's try, because I'm trying to grasp and understand, let's say misunderstanding. MS understanding.
Got it. Misunderstanding. Got it.
I have a question, Gus.
Yes, sir.
Did you hear about Jarrod Zimmer being caught in Ferguson? He held, I think, two teams at gunpoint.
Did you say George Zimmerman?
He was caught in Ferguson with holding two. He held two teams, two black teams at gunpoint, and they found a weapon, a car full of weapons that belonged to him. And I think they arrested him or something.
Wow. I'm just looking at the front page on Google. I didn't know anything about this until you all said it. One of the reports said that he was not arrested, and then another report says that he was arrested while visiting Ferguson. So the most recent one says that he was not arrested, though.
I guess because he thought that since he killed Trayvon Martin, he said, hey, why not go and get two more?
Oh, wait a minute. Oh, man, this says, man, I just talked to Dr. Okay, the report I'm reading, like I said, I didn't hear about any of this until you all brought it up, so I have to catch up. This is from Epic Times. George Zimmerman not arrested in Ferguson, not at Mike Brown funeral, but Department of Justice probe in Trayvon Martin case ongoing. George Zimmerman wasn't arrested in Ferguson, Missouri a few days ago, and he wasn't at Michael Brown's funeral. The bogus report was posted on a satire website, National Report, last week. It said that he was following two black teenagers before getting nabbed by police. According to a disclaimer that has now been removed, National Report doesn't post real news stories. The disclaimer said, disclaimer, National Report is a news and political satire web publication which may or may not use real names. often in semi-real or mostly fictitious ways. All news articles contained within National Report are fiction and presumably fake news. Any resemblance to the truth is purely coincidental. The views expressed by writers on this site are theirs alone and are not reflective of the fine journalistic and editorial integrity of National Report. I'm glad this came up because I see this is going to be a problem. I spoke with Dr. Welsing, I think this was in June. This was private. I spoke to her, and she said, Noel Ignatieff, who's been a guest on the program, she said that there was a report where he said that white men should commit suicide to end racism. And she was reading me this report that I knew was bogus. It was on a site like The Onion or something. And people had posted it on my Facebook page. I remember this came out like last year. People put it on my Facebook page and some other sites, and I kept like taking it down and telling people this is not true, this is bogus. They interviewed Noel Ignatieff. He said he did not say this. He doesn't know where this came from. If you track it back, you can find the site where it originated, and it's the same thing. They give a disclaimer that they don't post real news. And I told Dr. Welsing, and she said, man, that is really confusing. They should not be doing that, because she says the impact it'll have is where people just get very cynical. And so they will just say that, oh, that's, you know, that's not even true. They'll just start to take that position about everything, that that's not true, that that's probably fake, that that's probably satire. She said, I think that is a part of racism. And if you remember The Onion, that's the site that had that tweet about Kwavenjine Wallace that called her a little cunt. During the award ceremony last year, that was from The Onion. And they do the same sort of thing where they put these fake stories, fabricated reports online. But she got very serious about that just because someone gave it to her as though it was real. And she said, particularly if they're putting reports up that are related to racism, she said, I think this could be very dangerous. And I think this could be being done deliberately just so that people, their first inclination is to not believe something. When somebody makes a report of racism, they'll just say, oh, that's fake. That probably came from The Onion website, or that's not real, or whatever the case may be, when it actually is. So, and I've said this a couple times before, but I'm glad if this turns out that this is bunk, that this is bogus, I'm glad it came up, because I had said before for folks to kind of make sure when you read a news site to kind of make sure it's a valid source where you're getting it from, and maybe even double check it to see if it's on other sites, if other people are reporting this, because there seems like there's more of these fabricated reports coming out that are directly related to racism. So, yeah, if I'm incorrect, let me know if other folks see that this is substantiated.
I have another comment, and this happened to me randomly when I was in public. Of course, you all may know how most of them are very sophisticated with their racism. You know, the code is you can say something racist, but use it in forms of jokes or use it in forms of conversations in order to make it appear less racist to those who are non-white, but also in jokes, and make it appear funny to those who are non-white, but also funny to the suspected racist, by all means of dehumanizing their victims. Okay, I was in a restroom one time. Two white guys walk into the restroom. This is a true story, by the way. And one of the guys looked at me and started smirking. He said, hey, Bob. And Bob said, hey, Jim. And all of a sudden, they started talking to me Ebonics. They didn't have to say black. Ebonics was a code word for black. And after they finished with their conversation, Bob said, okay, Jim, are you okay? He said, oh, yeah. And Phyllis said, my IQ has gotten low ever since I started talking this way. So in other words, if you put two and two together, with Ebonics being a code word for black, they was trying to equate the black use of speech, which is mainly a speech, Ebonics is mainly a speech spoken in impoverished areas. So basically, they were trying to equate blacks with having low IQ. But they tried to say it in a way to make it sound less obviously racist. You see what I'm saying?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Well, I'm not surprised at all. You just wanted to share that, or was it a question about dealing with that, or?
No, I just wanted to share that.
Oh, okay.
I mean, the reason why I wanted to share that, because if anybody who's listening to the show and who may be confused, like the caller that you was talking about with the ethnicity of origin, when you was asking him about his ethnicity of origin, I was basically referring that to that situation that you and him got into, because, you know, sometimes there may be blacks who are victims of white supremacy who are confused as to how to handle certain situations when they are involved with white people, or how to handle certain situations when they are basically told something that's racist and different things like that. So that's the reason why I brought that statement.
Got it. Yeah, the jokes, I felt like there have been a lot more of those types of incidents where white people, they can mask their racism in a joke. And that way it's, you don't have a sense of humor, or you're sensitive, because that's a real popular one, that you're just so sensitive, or they won't even say that the person committed an act of racism. They'll say that the person made insensitive remarks, or racially insensitive remarks. And they'll just try and make it on a kind of a childish level, as though, you know, oh, we're sorry we hurt your feelings, as opposed to we were practicing racism, white supremacy. But there's a lot of that where they just get to make these sort of racist jokes and what have you, and even do it in the presence of non-white people sometimes, with the hope that either they won't really grasp what's going on, or they'll just laugh with them to try to fit in and that sort of thing. I think that's a very, very increasingly popular racist behavior on the part of white folks.
Right. Because there have been certain sectors of black people who hang around these people, or who have people like this in their family due to interracial marriages. And, you know, even though they are family members, or even though they're friends, there are still white people out there who would basically say derogatory things towards them, or still feel certain ways towards them, even though they may profess in their faces that they are not racist and different things like that.
Right.
And, you know, most blacks who are confused, by the way, or other non-whites in general, may not know how to handle the situation, or may feel embarrassed about the situation when, you know, all I'm saying is that I'm laying out a few pointers as to how to, you know, pinpoint to whether they're being racist towards you or not in everyday life situations.
Right, right. Absolutely. I completely agree. I don't know, the person that dialed in, I don't know if he was a white person or a non-white person, because he didn't respond. I try not to guess, particularly over the phone. I have my assumptions, but I try not to guess about that. So might have been a white person. I don't know. But yeah, I definitely agree with, in terms of that, the confusion and getting caught. I think a lot of people, what you said, the folks that are in these tragic arrangements, or whether they have a quote unquote white family member, I think they get caught in those situations a lot too, where they make those kind of remarks and people try to struggle and figure out how to respond, what to say, that sort of thing, or even what to how to process those type of comments.
Right. Because, well, I remember one day I was so mad and I got on a train and I was so confused. I was angry as to what happened in Ferguson with the, because I did not know they had the National Guard out there. I thought that was just SWAT. But as I started looking at the news, they stated that they were the National Guard. And I just grabbed my phone and I got on the train and I just started talking about, you know, society and white supremacy on a train full of white folks and black folks. And the white folks were staring at me, and they had a certain look on their faces to, I cannot believe he's saying this. And I said that any black person on this train may not have enough balls to say the words that I'm saying in front of these white people, because they're scared of these white people, because they depend on these white people economically. And after I was finished with the video and most of the white people have gotten off the train, there was this black guy that was sitting next to me who was soaking up everything I was saying, who decided to speak after the fact the white folks are off the train. And I think that is the problem. And I think that's the problem as black people. We are so easily conquered by these people because we're afraid to speak out, because we know that as we depend on these people economically, you know, we can have all those things taken away from us.
Mm-hmm. White people are scary. I definitely don't get upset. Scary. I don't get upset with any non-white person if they're fearful of white. The book we read tonight, man, that they estimate of 200 black people could have been more than that killed. White people are definitely scary, but having courage, I think that was our word for the day for one of our previous broadcasts. And I think we need more of that, people who are fearless and have the courage to speak truthfully and not be in denial, as Dr. Welsing says, not be in denial and be willing to speak honestly about our terrible situation and trying to solve that problem. So I definitely commend anybody else who's willing to go out and speak and be willing to speak truthfully publicly about this problem. And you even, it seems, encourage another black person to open up and share a word or two on what you had to say. So right on. We need hopefully this event, the tragedy, you know, we've all been watching, hopefully that will motivate more folks to speak up and speak honestly about, you know, what seems to be the central issue that we are looking at right now. Any of the other folks that are online, did y'all have comments you wanted to make on what's been shared or any other? I got to make sure I get, man, I would kill myself. Mr. Bills is married to a black female. I was trying to get there when he disloved. That's why I said I think that could have been a major act of racism. He is married to a black female. I did not start with that because that information came out we had been talking for about a half hour privately when I was trying to get him on the program. And he got to the end. He said, well, I don't know if I'd want to talk about it on the program, but just FYI, I am married to a black female. So, you know, I feel like I have a particular insight to these types of problems and how black people are mistreated by white people. And I just thought, wow, that is fascinating to know. I will keep that in mind as I read your book. And I was trying to get there, but he dipped out on us. But he is married to a black female and, you know, I've already been very clear in my view on that. Any of the folks online?
I'm sorry. Who was that wanted to go?
Well, it was just Karma. I just wanted to relate that here in Texas, and I live in a very rural area, there was a non-white man who was living with a white woman, and somehow they got into an altercation one morning, Governor Perry sent SWAT out after him. This is a Latino man. SWAT, the Texas Rangers, the federal marshals, the Houston Police Department, and the local police department. They brought in tanks. They had checkpoints with armed people with assault rifles that I had to stop at a few miles. And they had the gunboat helicopters with the automatic guns. And this is just for one Mexican guy, you know, who was purported to have hit his white girlfriend and then fled. So anyway. That police state militia thing, that's been going on a long time, and I'm sure no one on this show heard about that, and that was about 4 years ago. And next, I was coming back from the gym with three of my younger cousins, and they were much younger. These were much younger cousins. And they just pulled us over one night and forced me out of the car, and one stood back, you know, with his weapon on me, and I'm like, that's only because there were four black heads in a car. And the children told me, they said, oh, he's been tailing you for a long time, Karma. So I'm like, okay. And then another time I was escorting some elderly relatives, and there were four black heads in a car, but they told me he turned around as soon as he was close enough to see that the other heads were gray. So I think it's just a matter of how many black people you have in a car. Once you get over that, I think one of the guests was telling us that they used to do armed patrols and knew that as long as there was only two, they were good to go. But once you got three, that was considered a gang. So I think anytime they see three or more black people together in a car, that's a problem. That's a problem. They're going to pull you over. Doesn't matter what. Three black people in a car is a problem. Three black people together is a problem. I think I just wanted to let you know that those things go on all the time, and no one is aware.
Oh yeah, yeah. Sorry about that. In case you all may not have known, in San Francisco, California, police shot and killed this black teen. I think he shot him five times. Because he didn't want to pay a bus fare, and he took off running from the cops.
Oh, that's Kenneth Harding Jr. Isn't that the one that happened 2011, summer two, about this time, 2011? Is that the one they let him bleed to death in the middle of the street?
No, I think this one was in San Francisco.
This was in San Francisco.
Okay, that probably was the same one. I didn't really check the date. I just saw it on Facebook posted. And I think they said they shot him 5 times.
I don't recall the total number of times that they shot him, but I know it was about this time. It might have been August or July, but it was 2011. I think it was right before, or I guess it had to be July, because I think it was before the London riots in 2011, and that was August. So, but I think that's Kenneth Harding Jr. It was a black male. He didn't pay the bus fare. They said he had a gun, of course. This was broad daylight. They shot him. I don't recall how many times they shot him, but you said 5. And he was lying in the middle of the street, bleeding to death. And they have videos. I remember that. I used one of them in one of the videos I made on YouTube. But they have videos where he's in the middle of the street, bleeding to death. They didn't call paramedics immediately. They just got armed white men walking around his body in the middle of the street. And then he died right there on the scene. But I think that's Kenneth Harding Jr. who you're talking about.
Okay.
Hello, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. The one quick thing that stood out to me with tonight's program was right before the mysterious disconnect with Mr. Bill, the caller that was unfortunately not wanting to share his racial classification. He made the statement of saying that, you know, we shouldn't generalize all white people. And I think he asked a question in reference to saying, you know, don't you think that that's correct? And quickly, Mr. Bills, I noted that quickly Mr. Bills said, you know, yeah, you know, I don't think that that's correct. I may be incorrect, but I thought that's what I heard. I agree with what you're saying. I don't think it's correct to just generalize all white people. And that stood out to me. That just stood out to me. I wanted to share that.
I think you are accurate. I think that's exactly how things went. That was one of the first points that he made about generalizing about all whites. I think he said all blacks, too. And then Mr. Bill spoke up pretty quickly to say, oh, yeah, I definitely agree. And we shouldn't do that. that probably does have some relevance for him being a white person. I obviously do not agree with that in terms of white people in talking about racism, white supremacy. I think it is most accurate to look at them collectively and what they have done. And if there are some white people who do not believe in practice racism, white supremacy, I've not found them yet.
And what's sad is how you find whites getting involved in the riot in Ferguson and also with the Trayvon Martin case 2 years ago. You see, it's just like this continuation of whites wanting to get involved in these sorts of events in order to confuse the victims, but also take the focus off on what needs to be done properly in order to ensure the safety for the community.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think one of the listeners, I think these events, it just becomes racial theater, to steal Dr. John Hoberman's term. He's been a guest repeatedly as well. But just where it's like theater for white people. This is entertainment where they can sit around and watch things unfold. It's almost like reality television. You know, they can participate. They can donate money and watch and see how much they can raise for Officer Wilson. And maybe they can go out and protest and demonstrate for Officer Wilson. They can get involved. Then they can watch television and call Al Sharpton names or call Attorney General Eric Holder names or call Captain Ron Johnson names or President Obama, whomever else they want to get mad at. In my opinion, it's total racial theater for whites. They can even pretend, the white people that want to do the confusion, hey, I can go to protest to Ferguson and protest, and I can get in the march, and you know, I marched with Al Sharpton. I was at the funeral. I was tear gassed too. Look, I got the scars on my body right now. I got hit with a rubber bullet. I mean, it's just total theater for whites, and where they can also add that confusion so that non-white people don't get an accurate understanding, so that we think that there are some good whites. There are some whites who are equally upset about this, and they, you know, they're fighting in Michael Brown's name. You know, that they do the same thing. They did the same thing with Troy Davis. They did the same thing with Trayvon Martin. This happens on a Oscar Grant. The CC McDonald, the black female, she was attacked by a white mob of terrorists. I think it was in Minnesota. She just got out of prison, but they do this on a pretty regular basis, and just where they get to have fun in incidents where black people have been terrorized.
But also, it could be because of exploitation. Like, these white folks could probably be getting involved in order to take notes, in order to arouse the, you know, the black people who are involved, you know what I'm saying, to make sure that, you know, nothing secretly pops off. So,
oh, they always are reconning. That I totally agree with that. They always are taking notes.
And I remember, if not hearing you say it, or Neely Fuller said that whenever one white person is doing something racist that could sabotage, you know, the white social order, or have another white person fight with that white person in order to gain the confidence in their victims.
Just, I think, Pam, she describes that good cop, bad cop, but they will generally have at least one white person come off as being the not racist white person. Like, I'm not with them, and this is deplorable, this is horrific. I think I've heard Mr. Fuller, the example he used, if you look at a lot of the photographs for when a black person was lynched, or a group of black people, you might see one or two white people who are crying and lamenting this is horrendous, and I can't believe that we've done this, and blah, blah, blah. And that just, in my opinion, it strengthens the system where people think that exactly what was said. It's not all white people. There are some good white people. Some of these white people are okay. They're not racist, and, you know, this is my friend Ted. This is my friend Susan. You know, we've hung out for years. Or this is my husband, Frank, or whatever. I think they're very good at that, and it makes their system stronger. But I absolutely, with Ferguson, it's tons of white people. They've been writing articles and talking about the militarization of the police and all that other malarkey. Wow, this is a big subject. But then they just go right on helping to refine the system, taking notes, and they can guide that. That I think is also important, that they can guide the thinking of non-white people in how they process and understand this problem, racism, white supremacy, because, hey, I'm a white person. I know that they're going to listen to what I have to say. The good white anti-racists who have commentary on all of this, that just, it has a huge impact all the way around.
But, right.
Any other comments before we wrap things up? We'll be back tomorrow. Dr. Tommy Curry, be with us. I think it's his third visit. Should be joining us. Texas A&M professor, staying with the state of Texas. But any other quick comments before we conclude? Everybody's good? Outstanding. Again, we should be here every day this week. Dr. Tommy Curry tomorrow, Dr. Charles Hayden on Wednesday, Norm Stamper on Thursday. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings on Friday, Book Club, and Saturday, the Compensatory Call-In. So stay tuned. Hopefully it'll be constructive, solid information, hopefully, as we wrap up the month of August and the summer. There was some interesting reading material available today. Folks had an opportunity to kind of keep up with what was being reported in the news. I saw quite a bit of just interesting material all the way around. The New York Times, they had some interesting reports on what's happening in Ferguson. The Guardian, they had a great piece where it was a non-white male. Apparently he has a white mother and a white brother. And his white brother is an enforcement official. His white brother shot a black person. And the non-white author of this piece is saying that he thinks his white brother shot this black person because they were black. Basically saying he thinks his white brother is a racist. And he has it's incredible. He talks about this conversation that he has with his white mom about all this. And his white mom is, of course, defending her white son, the author's white brother. It is fascinating. And I think at one point she even says that her white son is more black than her non-white son who's writing this piece. I mean, it's fascinating. I would encourage folks to read it. I put it on my Facebook page. It's I'm black, my brother's white, and he's a cop who shot a black man on duty. And his name is Zach Stafford. That's the non-white male who authored the piece. It's at The Guardian. Again, it's on my Facebook page if you want to check it out. I'll tweet it as well. And Isabel Wilkerson, she wrote a great piece as well. Super gorgeous Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns. She wrote a piece about this. That continuum that I talked about where unarmed black people are still somehow thought of, perceived to be a threat and worthy of lethal violence. She wrote a piece as well. It's at The Guardian. Her piece is titled Mike Brown Shooting and Jim Crow Lynchings Have Too Much in Common. It's subtitled. There's more to it. But that's the gist of it. Mike Brown Shooting and Jim Crow Lynchings Have Too Much in Common by the lovely, talented Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, which we did on our book study session as well. I'll try and post some of the other stuff, but there's a lot of interesting commentary. Great. If you're paying attention to racism right now, great time. Just check that. You can just go get the newspaper every day. It is chock full of articles and reports directly related to racism, white supremacy. You should be able to share with other friends, family members, anybody, if they come out of their mouth saying, oh, man, racism is not a problem. What do you do? Bang. Snap out the New York Times. Bang. CNN. Bang. You can just hit them. Bang, bang, bang. Even the BBC. They had a report front page where they were talking to a black female officer in St. Louis, and they were asking her about racism and what her thoughts were about all this. And she said, absolutely. She talked about some of the things that she observed. It's all over the place. That's one thing that we should try to take advantage of in these incidents when whites are forced to talk publicly, openly, directly about racism, white supremacy as a problem. Pick apart what they say, share it with other folks, and bam, any non-white people that you care about who are saying racism is not a problem. Well, why is it all over the place? Why is it on the front page of the BBC? Why is it on the front page of The Guardian? Why is it on the front page of CNN? What do you have another explanation for all of this if racism is not the problem? And see what they say. We will be back tomorrow. Same program time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Dr. Tommy Curry. Looking forward to hearing from him again. Invest if you think the program is constructive. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener supported counter racist radio. PayPal is in the top right corner. If you are not feeling PayPal, you can drop us an email and we can get you a mailing address if you would be more comfortable investing in that manner. Thanks so much for the folks tuned in, people who called. Hope it was a constructive investment of your Monday evening. We'll be back in about 24 hours. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other victims of racism. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Help us understand the importance of black self-respect. Help us manifest black self-respect in everything that we do. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. Context of white supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.